You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Ida Tuma Slimman. She is a member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, and chairwoman there of the Committee on the Status of Women and Gender Equality. She is joining us by phone from Israel, but she did recently tour the United States. Her lengthy resume includes 3 years as editor-in-chief of Al Ittihad, the only Arabic daily newspaper in Israel, and for the past 9 years she has served as Secretary of the World Peace Council. I am not aware of any member of the U.S. Congress who is part of any peace organization. Ida Tuma Slimman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
Thank you for coming on. When you were in the United States and I heard you speak and met with you, you spoke a good deal about the new nation state law in Israel. Can you give people a summary of what that is?
Well, the Jewish nation state law has been legislated as a basic law, which is supposed to be part of the constitution to be formed in the future. Nobody knows when, because as you know, Israel is 70 years old and still don't have a constitution till today, but have a group of basic laws, and this is one, the major one of them. It is. It was legislated in 19th of July, and the debates surrounding it were really very controversial, because this law actually designed the state to be a Jewish state. It doesn't mention 20% of the citizens of Israel who are Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel, indigenous people who we existed even before on this land, even before the state was formulated. We are not mentioned at all. It says, the law says and determines that it's a Jewish state. It's open for Jewish people from all over the world. The state takes responsibility to defend and to enrich the life of Jewish people all over the world, but do not mention 20% of its citizens. This law also have different components of defining the state symbols, the flag, and all the components of a state, but do not mention anything about the borders, something that makes us very worried, especially that the law starts with two words, the land of Israel. And we think that bringing this terminology that is a biblical terminology, a Zionist terminology, into a civil law is very dangerous in our opinion, because it keeps in this political context that is evolving in the last few months, it keeps the borders of Israel open to annexate more and more territories of the Palestinian territories, the occupied Palestinian territories. I can go on and explain about the fact that is including Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which means it is in contradiction with the international law that says very clearly that East Jerusalem is an occupied territory. And it continues to one of the most, in my opinion, it's a scandal to have item in the law, one article that says that developing and enlarging and creating Jewish locality settlement called by the law is a nation value, a high nation value, which means discriminating very clearly against 20% of the citizens. This law put the infrastructure for a new situation in Israel, where there will be two different status of citizenship, one for the Jews and one for the Arabs. This is an infrastructure or a beginning very officially of an apartheid regime in Israel.
Yes, indeed. It sounds like what we might think of if in the United States, in the southern part of the United States, laws were to be enacted today to create white communities and to legislate.
Yeah, imagine that in the United States they will declare that, although in reality, sometimes we have these situations, that small communities are composed of one, like only Jewish communities in it, but to put it in a basic law very clearly that they will create and develop and make it a high value, only Jewish settlements, it means very clearly that you are not going to invest anything or less investment in other communities, which create, as I said, a classification of citizenship inside Israel.
It seems there's always been a contradiction between being a democracy and being a Jewish nation, but this seems more open. This seems more blatant to openly admit and put into law that you're going to be a Jewish nation. Well, how does one reconcile that with the idea of democracy?
Well, democracy is not mentioned in the basic law. This basic law do not mention two important words that usually any constitution or any basic law should include, equality and democracy. These two words are not mentioned in that law, and actually it is not mentioned in any other law, the word equality between the citizens in Israel. But there is, in the issue of democracy, till today, there was a law that defining Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. And there was a debate going on, especially on the background of what is created lately by the right-wing government, that there is a built-in contradiction between being Jewish and democratic. Because the minute you define a state by an ethnic group or ethnic affiliation, you are not putting the basis for a real democracy. The minute you prefer one ethnic group over the other, in my opinion, this is not democratic. And this debate was going on for a long time. But it looks like the right-wing government, Mr. Netanyahu's government, has decided that this debate should not continue, and if there is a contradiction between Jewish and democracy, now they declare it very clearly, we prefer Jewish rather than democracy.
You mentioned the words Land of Israel as a biblical reference. That could actually be taken to mean much more than the currently occupied territories, couldn't it?
Yes, of course, because there is also a debate. What does it mean, the land of Israel? Usually they say that in the biblical way, it's between the sea and the river. The sea is the Mediterranean. Everybody knows that. That is the border from the western side of Israel. But the river, there is a debate about it. Is it the Jordanian River or it is the rivers in Iraq? Which means it can extend to include Jordan and parts of Syria. And actually, this basic law is including also the Golan Heights, which are Syrian territories occupied since 1967. It is included in the definition of the State of Israel. And Israel has annexed this land to it, despite the international law, despite what is agreed upon in international resolutions, which means that the, let's say, the appetite to include and to annexate more and more lands can be beyond the Palestinian territories even.
Indeed. We're speaking with Ida Tuma Sliman, who is a member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. What has been the resistance to this law, including a general strike?
Well, we decided from the beginning, what we should maybe mention, David, that this law, although it was defined as a basic law and part of the Constitution to be, it did not really had a consensus among the Israeli population, including the Jewish population in Israel. Only 62 members out of 120 in the Knesset voted with this law, and 55 opposed it, voted against, and 2 abstained, which means it's almost a division of 52 to 48% of the population. That's why we said from the beginning that we want to defend our citizenship, our existence as a minority inside Israel. We want to defend the possibility of a political agreement that end the occupation of the Palestinian territories. That's why we are calling to abolish this law. And we started by, of course, parliamentarian work, and we will continue the parliamentarian work to abolish this law. But there is also a need to show that the masses are against this law. That's why we, on the 11th of August, we had a big demonstration in Tel Aviv with more than 60,000 participants who called for abolishing this law and against this law. We also, as a joint list, the coalition of 4 parties in the Knesset, the third faction in the Knesset, started also or launched a diplomatic efforts, international diplomatic efforts. I visited the United States. I had meetings with UN officials, and we had also met UN officials in Geneva and in the EU Parliament to make all of the world aware of the dangerous sides of this law and how it is in contradiction of all the accepted norms in the world. And we will continue these efforts. We will also addressed the Supreme Court in Israel. There are 6 appeals to the Supreme Court against this law. We expect that next month the Supreme Court should start looking into those appeals. It was attacked by the Minister of Law in Israel, Minister of Justice, Ayelet Shaked, who did not understand how could the judges of the Supreme Court even think about accepting these appeals against the law. And she said very clearly that they will not allow judges of the Supreme Court to reject or to criticize laws that are legislated in the Knesset, which means it is going to be a very clear crisis with the judiciary system, between the political regime and the judiciary system on their authority to criticize or to analyze any kind of law if it is in contradiction with the basic, even what was declared in the independence declaration of Israel. We have to understand that Israel committed itself, when it was recognized by the United Nations, it committed itself to the declaration of the United Nations, and by this law, it is withdrawing from its commitment. And I think the world should look into this. The world in the past rejected the existence of an apartheid regime in South Africa and should also have a clear position about having a new apartheid regime in this world that is evolving in Israel.
Yes, it should. Ida Tuma Sliman, you came to the United States and you talked about the severe criticism that parties in the Israeli government were leveling against you in Israeli media, it seems they let you back in the country and they haven't stopped you. What have you been up against now?
Well, first of all, there were complaints by other MKs from the right wing against me to the general attorney to investigate how am I sabotaging the and making harm to the international relations of Israel, which means as if I'm violating an existing law in Israel that might end if people are... if someone is accused by this accusation and being called a traitor as the way they did to me, it can lead to a felony that brings 10 years of prison. But of course they will let me in. I'm not only a citizen of Israel, I'm representing people who elected me to echo these voices, who elected me to represent their needs, their values, their what they think they want to see in the country they are living in the state they are citizens of. We want democracy, we want peace, we want to end the occupation because we believe that occupation is bad for the Palestinian people and it is bad for the Israeli Jewish people. So what I'm standing for, in my understanding, is international values that all the humanity should stand for. And what I'm struggling for is a better future for all the people in this region, not the thing that the Israeli government is doing. And of course, they can persecute us, they can call us names, they are inciting against us. This is not the first time that this government is inciting against the representatives of the Palestinian minority inside Israel. As you might remember very well, on the last election in 2015, how Netanyahu went out on the day of the election and asked people to come and to vote because the Arabs are coming to vote in droves. I mean,
right.
If that was said in any country, imagine in the United States, someone will stand up or a prime minister or president will say, come and rescue us, the Jews or the African Americans are coming to vote in droves. This is a clear incitement against, and this is not the first time that they are inciting against us. And this is part of the struggle, is to make your message out clear there, on the contrary, what we are standing for can bring solidarity from all over the world and not what they are trying to create here.
Well, it doesn't take much imagination in the United States, where we do have a president who incites racist violence and says the Mexicans are a bunch of rapists and criminals coming to get us. But it is something that we ought to be taking seriously and addressing here as well as in Israel. Has there been a general strike proposed? Is that, am I right about that?
Yeah, we just had a general strike, a Palestinian general strike for the first time in the last 70 years. It was a general strike not only among the Palestinians inside Israel, but among the Palestinian people all over the Palestinian occupied territories and all over the refugee camps, because everybody understands that this law is not only damaging the rights of equal citizenship and existence of the Palestinian minority, but it's also damaging and trying to end eventually the possibility for the two-state solution, or what I called the creation of a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel. And if you mentioned already your president, we know very well about the relations that are very, very close and between Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Trump. And we know that they share a lot of the ideas. Look what happened just recently in the General Assembly of the United Nations and the declarations that came later on. For the first time, Mr. Trump said that he loves the idea of a two-state solution, but immediately corrected himself, saying, but it should be agreed upon both parts, when he knows very well that Mr. Netanyahu has declared on the same day that he will never agree for an independent, real independent state of Palestine. He would like to see the Palestinians ruling themselves, but the whole, what is called security issues, should be in the hands of Israel, meaning creating a kind of a smaller authority than it is existing now, dealing with the everyday life. He wants a continuous occupation without taking the burden of occupying another people. Let them deal with themselves internally, but we will continue to occupy them. If this is what Netanyahu think about the two-state solution, then we understand very clearly that the moves that were created by the United States of the President of the United States lately, since, you know, May, moving the embassy from Tel Aviv, the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, despite the international resolutions about this and the international law of East Jerusalem as an occupied territory, including the cuts of budgets against the UNRWA, and trying to redefine who is a refugee. Those two things are the most important. You know, there were four issues delayed in the negotiations between Palestinians and Israel. The Jerusalem issue, and Mr. Trump said very clearly after moving the embassy, we just finished the issue, settled the issue of Jerusalem. The the decisions about the UNRWA is again relating to the second issue that was delayed, the refugees issues, and he thinks this way he will settle the issue of refugees. Netanyahu, from his part, is saying that the third issue, the security, he wants to continue to have the security in his hand, controlling the Palestinian territories, which means they are preparing for what is called the century, the deal of the century, that we heard in the next few months will be declared by the administration, the American administration. They are trying to liquidate the Palestinian issue. They are trying to enforce the Palestinian leadership to agree or to compromise any solution that would be suggested through, making this leadership weaker and weaker. But I think that will lead us to a new crisis and to a new cycle of violence and bloodshed that nobody needs in the region.
Indeed. We have just a few minutes left, and there's problems on top of problems. But another one, of course, is the threat of war with Iran. Israel has nuclear weapons with no inspections. Iran has no nuclear weapons with the most severe inspections any nation has ever faced. But Mr. Netanyahu and his U.S. allies are telling us that Iran is this major threat. Do the Israeli people believe that? What are the views toward a possible war within Israel?
Well, I hope there won't be any war regarding Israel and Iran, because I believe this time it's going to be a total disaster. And it's going to be a continuous war that nobody wants, and the people of the region will pay a high price for such a war. I think that Netanyahu is playing with fire, you say. He wants to show the world that he is that the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories is not the major issue in the Middle East, and want to divert the attention to Iran. And by this way, he is also gaining some kind of support of the some of the reactionary Arab regimes like Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries, and that will also, he will use this kind of support also to put pressure on the Palestinian leadership to compromise the political agreement to be signed. In my opinion, Mr. Netanyahu understands very well that it is dangerous to go into a war at this point. He wants to divert the attention from the nuclear weapon Israel has, and want to continue to be the only superpower in the Middle East.
What can people outside of the Middle East and outside of Israel and people in the United States do most directly to help at this time?
Well, I think that solidarity with the Palestinian people, solidarity with democratic forces, Israeli democratic forces, including the Palestinian minority inside Israel, is very, very important. Showing the Israeli government and the Israeli leaders that they cannot continue this kind of policy without paying a price. Please question your representatives in the Congress, in the Senate, about their policy and their positions toward what's happening in the Middle East. Israel is getting a lot of military and financial support from your administration. Most of the killing that is happening on Gaza borders is happening with weapons and ammunition that is given by the American people. And I think it's about time for the American people to stand up and to say we are not willing to give a hand to these killings and what is and oppressing other people in the region. I think it's very also important to make the Israeli government understand that they are not welcomed as long as they are pushing for this policy and practicing occupation against other people. Of course, the world has created different ways of putting diplomatic pressure, but also public pressure. And I know that the BDS is very active nowadays and getting more and more power in the United States. And I think it's about time for the Israeli government to understand that there is a price for continuous occupation.
Very good advice. Ida Tuma Slimman is member of Knesset and the chairwoman of the Committee on the Status of Women and Gender Equality. Ida, thank you for everything you're doing and for taking the time to come on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counter-Strike.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as we record the show on October 4th, it looks as though Brett Kavanaugh will be confirmed for the Supreme Court, despite so very many things. Why are Republicans so set on pushing through a candidate opposed by a coalition of Christian churches, as well as more than 1,000 law professors, as well as anybody concerned about sexual assault? And beyond his temperament, what ought we know about Kavanaugh's record as a judge? We'll talk about that with Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Also on the show, Bezos Unbound, says the cover of the current Forbes magazine, stating of the head of Amazon.com, quote, "He's built the most innovative and feared juggernaut of the 21st century, and every industry is now fair game," close quote. So that's good? Is it appropriate for media to approach Amazon as though it's simply a better mousetrap? And Bezos, as though his bank account of $160 billion can coexist happily alongside workers who've just had their minimum wage pushed up to $15 an hour? Where do we have the conversation about the impact of Amazon's size, its influence, and its values on community? We'll hear from journalist Neil DeMoss, author of most recently The Brooklyn Wars. That's all coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Donald Trump's public mockery of Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who testified she was assaulted by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, was an acutely despicable spectacle in an administration that is no shirker when it comes to despicable spectacle. But the Kavanaugh hearings, the FBI quote-unquote investigation into allegations against him, the whole process seemed to indicate more serious failures than Trump's vindictive creepiness. What is going on here and what might it mean for the Supreme Court going forward? Marjorie Cohn is professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and deputy secretary general of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She joins us now by phone from San Diego. Welcome back to Counterspin, Marjorie Cohn.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
Well, we're in media res here, of course. We just heard this morning, October 4th, that the FBI had completed its investigation, which Susan Collins called very thorough, despite it not including statements from Ford or dozens of others who wanted to contribute. I have so many questions, but they really all kind of amount to, how is this happening? How are we at a place where a man who shout-sobbed his way through his hearings, snarling and accusing and making clear that he hates Democrats, the Clintons, and the left, could even be considered to have the temperament appropriate to a Supreme Court justice?
Well, that's an excellent question, but it's very clear, and it's been clear from the start, that the Republican leadership, in concert with Donald Trump, is going to ram this nomination through so that they can achieve a solid right-wing majority on the Supreme Court, which will last for decades and will reverse many of the rights that we hold dear. The Republicans know that Kavanaugh would provide a reliable vote against immigrants, workers, voters, and gay and transgendered people. He would deliver a dependable vote for employers, private property, and church-state bonding, and they can rest assured that he would do his best to immunize Trump from criminal liability and enable him to continue their mean-spirited right-wing agenda. And this is more important to them than any judicial temperament, than any credible allegations of sexual assault, because the bottom line issue, one of the most significant issues, is abortion rights, reproductive rights, and overturning Roe v. Wade, in addition to gay rights. And they have rationalized all of these other horrors to that end.
Kavanaugh seems so tainted, though, at this point. Why not just some other conservative? What is it about the timeline that you think makes them feel like they have to keep going with this candidate over the objection of now, you know, millions of people?
Well, in part, they want Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court before the November 6th midterm elections, because if the Democrats achieve a majority in the Senate, then there might not be sufficient votes to confirm him after the election.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most immediate consideration, but they were in a hurry to get him confirmed by October 1st, which was the first day of the Supreme Court's new term, and they want to help ensure the outcome of several hot-button cases that are on the court's docket, including cases involving double jeopardy, immigration, age discrimination, and the Endangered Species Act, and there is a possibility that the court might decide to take up cases involving gerrymandering, gay and transgender rights, and the separation of church and state.
Well, you've been writing about Brett Kavanaugh for a while now, and you have pointed out that there's plenty to undermine his candidacy even before we get to sexual assault allegations. And those other things are, in a way, at risk almost of being overlooked. And one of the concerns is around his record on international law and the power of the president. What are the flags there? And again, they're nothing to do with his quote-unquote personality, but they're derived from his public record as a judge.
Well, keep in mind that international law, insofar as the United States has ratified treaties or customary international law, are part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, and yet Kavanaugh has nothing but scorn for international law, and he confuses international law with foreign law. International law, as I said, is treaty law and customary international law, which is customs that countries have built up over the years. But foreign law is totally different. It's the law of France or Brazil or Germany, and he conflates the two. Now that he's been on the Court of Appeals, and during the Bush administration's so-called war on terror, Kavanaugh almost always deferred to the president on executive power. Now, the Supreme Court during the Bush administration did check and balance the executive, the president, and said that federal courts have jurisdiction to hear habeas corpus petitions by Guantanamo detainees. They said that a U.S. citizen who's being held as an enemy combatant has due process rights to contest his detention. And they said that Bush's military commissions violated the Geneva Conventions and the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, in 2008, the Supreme Court ruled in Boumediene versus Bush that Guantanamo detainees held as enemy combatants have the right to file habeas corpus petitions in U.S. federal courts to say I'm being unlawfully held. But after Boumediene, Kavanaugh on the Court of Appeals did his best to try to neuter these habeas corpus rights that the Supreme Court had upheld in Boumediene in case after case. And also, Kavanaugh has a record of dangerous deference to the president, notwithstanding the case of Jones versus Clinton, the Paula Jones case, which said that a president has to answer to at least a civil case that didn't involve a criminal case. Kavanaugh doesn't think that a president should be bothered to answer to a civil or a criminal case while he's in office. And under U.S. versus Nixon, a unanimous Supreme Court said that Nixon had to turn over the tapes during the Watergate scandal, and that led to Nixon's resignation. And yet, although that case, U.S. versus Nixon, is a settled precedent, Kavanaugh has said he thinks it should be reconsidered. And one of the most disturbing things, Janine, is that in a Law Review article Kavanaugh wrote in 2014, he wrote that, yes, the Take Care Clause of the Constitution requires the president to enforce the law. It says that the president shall take care that the laws are faithfully executed. But then Kavanaugh went on to say, yes, the president has to enforce the law, quote, at least unless the president deems the law unconstitutional, in which event the president can decline to follow the statute until a final court order says otherwise. Unquote. So Kavanaugh would create a dangerous presumption in favor of a president who refuses to follow the law. That is very worrisome.
And it should be worrisome, I should think, to people of any political stripe, you know, allowing the president to make the law. And there are references also, well, we're in wartime, but of course, given that the war is the war on terror, it's like we're always going to be in wartime. So we can't really think of that as a temporary status.
Yes, that's the excuse for whatever the president wants to do. Oh, we're fighting terrorism, the war on terror. The war on terror is a misnomer. Terrorism is a tactic. It's not an enemy. And yet under the guise of this so-called war on terror, Bush and Obama and now Trump are decimating our civil liberties, and Congress, unfortunately, not in every case, and in some cases there's pushback, but largely defers to him, and the courts are the last resort to check and balance an out-of-control executive, and yet with Kavanaugh on the court, that checking and balancing is not going to happen.
It seems important for the conversation to kind of separate our concerns about Kavanaugh in particular, and then also this process that's happening that's allowing him to advance in this way. You know, I mean, there's the lack, as Anita Hill pointed out in an op-ed, the lack of a protocol for vetting charges of harassment or assault in confirmation hearings, which should have been put in place, you know, before Clarence Thomas, but certainly after. There's Jeff Flake saying, we're going to have an investigation by the FBI to last no longer than a week. What kind of investigation decides how long it's going to last before it starts? The process, I think, just seems so broken to folks. And I know that we knew that the Supreme Court was subject to partisan push and pull. I mean, Merrick Garland, George W. Bush, it's not a new thing. But I don't know, it's hard to see how anyone can, going forward, see the Supreme Court as a check or balance at this point.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think when Kavanaugh, and I say when because I think his confirmation is a foregone conclusion, especially because this so-called FBI investigation, which didn't even last a week, this perfunctory investigation, which ignored many people coming forward who had evidence, including a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary who would confirm and corroborate the allegations of Deborah Ramirez, who said that Kavanaugh waved his penis in her face and forcing her to touch it. It really is a farce, but Collins and Flake, at least the two of them, are getting political cover from this so-called week-long investigation, saying there's no new credible corroboration. It was a thorough report, whereas many, many people, and this is detailed in Jane Mayer and Ronan Farrow's New Yorker article, came forward and tried to contact the FBI saying that they had relevant information, and yet the FBI did not contact them. They gave it a lick and a promise. And evidently, you know, during his testimony, Kavanaugh said, oh, I've been through six FBI investigations and there's never been a problem. Well, actually, during the FBI investigation for his appointment to the Court of Appeals, the American Bar Association reduced their very qualified rating to qualified because there were problems with his judicial temperament. And we saw that on display in the hearings. A terrible judicial temperament. I mean, he was having tantrums. He was aggressive. He was acting, you know, I know you are, but what am I, with the senators, which is just unheard of. And I'm proud to say that I'm one of more than 1,000 law professors who signed a letter saying that he should not be confirmed solely on the basis of his judicial temperament, which is really, really beyond the pale.
Well, I understand that Chuck Schumer is asking for the FBI report to be made public along with the White House directive. I imagine that many folks who see it will or would think, well, yeah, this was a sham. But what does that outrage translate to? You know, what can we do? And is this a tipping point potentially for making actual structural changes to the court itself?
Well, I don't know about structural changes. I mean, that's a tall order. Yeah. But you see people in the streets today, yesterday, probably tomorrow and Saturday. The Me Too movement has really galvanized the whole issue of women and men, in some instances, being afraid to come forward to report sexual assault because of feelings of humiliation or the ramifications. And because of this time in history where Kavanaugh has been accused of these things in the wake of the Me Too movement, this has galvanized people all over this country. And these people are not going to go away. We are not going to go away. We are going to continue to pressure the branches of government. And the fact that there were two courageous women, survivors of sexual assault, in an elevator with Jeff Flake in his face, challenging him, is the only reason, I think, or certainly the primary reason, that he agreed to this investigation, this so-called investigation. So political pressure, and I'm talking about people pressure, really does have an effect, and we have to keep it up, and people should be sitting in Collins' office and Murkowski and Flake and Manchin, who are the swing voters, and they should be around the block, and they should be demanding that they vote no on this confirmation.
We've been speaking with Marjorie Cohn. You can find her most recent piece, Five Reasons Why the GOP is Rushing to Confirm Kavanaugh, online at truthout.org. That and other work at marjoriecohn.com. Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much, Janine.
Amazon got a PR boost from its announcement that, after considerable pressure, it would raise workers' minimum wage to $15 an hour. Immediately after, we learned that the company would simultaneously be cutting monthly bonuses and stock options, such that many warehouse employees have said they'll actually be getting less money. That sort of maneuver is one of the things that rubs many people wrong about Amazon, now one of the country's largest employers, along with responding to charges of abusive conditions by having select staffers maintain Twitter accounts in which they explain, Stepford-like, how glorious it is to work there. But maybe most galling is the disjuncture between nickel-and-dimed employees, some of whom report peeing in trash cans because bathroom breaks are recorded as time-off task, while Jeff Bezos is rich as Croesus. And how is it that a company with paid employees who rely on food stamps and that demands tremendous subsidies from communities just to locate there can be held up by media as an exemplar of success? It matters whether we label Amazon a success without asterisks and whether we're okay with the extent of its power. One with questions on that is journalist Neil DeMoss. His latest book is The Brooklyn Wars, and he joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome back to Counterspin, Neil DeMoss.
Always a pleasure.
Well, I think many people think of Amazon as a guilty convenience. You know, we know the company has problems, internal and societal. So if we use it, we feel culpable. And this frustrates me. You know, Amazon's malfeasances are not determined by people who don't have bookstores in their town, you know, or people who can't physically go out to the store, you know, but there's the limit. And you write about this in your recent piece for Gothamist, the limit of seeing ourselves only as consumers, you know, that's our only power is where we spend money, but it turns out not to be very much power. So I'll just ask you the question you pose in the piece. In the absence of a trust buster in the White House, is there anything that mere mortals can do to reduce Amazon's sway over our lives and pocketbooks? And then for those who may wonder, why should we want to reduce that sway?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I certainly empathize with everyone else who looks at Amazon as a convenient pleasure. You know, I mean, it is a phenomenal way to avoid thinking about where the best place is to get a product, where the cheapest place is to get a product. You just think, well, I've already got my Prime membership. You know, I'll just go to Amazon and they'll have it for some price that is probably okay. And the shipping's free, so it's great. And look, I can, you know, go and watch a TV show while I'm there. But one of the interesting things is, you know, we sort of have this idea of the way to respond to corporate malfeasance in our age is to vote with our pocketbooks, right? And we've learned from boycott movements. And, you know, I remember back 20, 30 years ago, there was a spate of, like, paperbacks that came out about, you know, how to shop for a better world. And it very much is sort of the ethos of modern times that you make a statement with your dollars. And that was not always the case. And one of the things I found interesting in researching this article was the degree to which that was, first of all, a response to some of the big corporate chains like A&P in the 20s and 30s trying to get people to identify more as consumers because they wanted people thinking and, you know, and voting on the basis of what's best for me for, you know, easy shopping, not what's best for me as a worker, what's best for me as a business owner who has to, you know, compete with these chains. And then again, after that, starting in the 60s and running through the 80s and 90s and up till today, consumer movements as a response to our lack of political power in other ways, right? You know, if Congress is all sold out to corporations, at least we can vote with our dollars. The problem, of course, being that that's not a very effective way of accomplishing things. So, you know, one of the things I tried to do in the article is sort of look at both what you can do when you go to shop, but also what you can do to affect our shopping choices and our corporate world outside of that sort of consumer basis.
Well, yeah, so much, first of all, that's presented as kind of eternal is actually just historical, you know, and there has been a shift. Now we talk about companies, are they good companies, are they bad companies? But it used to be that just bigness itself, just size itself of a, and power was considered to be a cause for concern.
Yeah, and you know, clearly Amazon with this announcement this week of, you know, raising their minimum wages is trying to cast themselves as we're not bad guys, we're good guys, right? And that's kind of not, you know, shouldn't be the point, right? I mean, it's nice that they're doing that, but does that mean that we should trust a company with massive control over all areas of our consuming experience and our entertainment experience and our cultural experience and the ability to compile, you know, massive amounts of data from our behaviors in all these different places? Does it make it better if they're nicer people rather than worse people? I mean, I guess a little bit. But really, if we're going back to the principle that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, the idea is really nobody should be trusted with that level of power, which is the whole point of the antitrust movement of late 19th and early 20th century. And I think one of the realizations here is, and what, you know, Stacy Mitchell was saying eloquently in my article, is that we need to not just approach this as how do we find the most conscientious way to shop, but we need to really have a return to antitrust. You know, we really haven't had a strong antitrust movement to break up these enormous monopolies in the last few decades. And, you know, regardless of whether it's Democrats or Republicans in power, we really need to start pushing in that direction.
Well, and what Stacy Mitchell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance says is that folks are starting to see that, she thinks, you know, that there was a period where Amazon was this bright, shiny thing that made life easier. And now it's starting to shift a bit to people recognizing that canceling your Prime account is not necessarily going to be enough, given that, as you report, a lot of what Amazon does is out of the reach of individuals. They're selling to public agencies, you know, they're selling, you know, over your head, in a sense. But there is movement afoot to talk about antitrust in a way that, that might make it more meaningful again.
Yeah, and the FTC is holding hearings, and there's an antitrust caucus in Congress now, and there are, you know, some rumblings. And I think things like, you know, obviously Facebook breaches and all the other sort of big malfeasance that we're clearly seeing by some of these big overarching corporations is starting to get attention not just from consumer advocates of the world, but also in Congress and in other places. But it's going to have to be a big push, obviously, right? Because, you know, Amazon and companies like that have the ability not just to lobby like crazy, but also to do things like try to undercut opposition by suddenly saying, hey, we're going to raise our minimum wages, which, again, is not nothing, but it's an attempt to deflect, right, an attempt to get people off their backs. I think something that is going to be a battle not just over the next year or two, but over the next decade or two to really sort of try and push back, again, in the same way that it took decades to fight the power of the monopolies, whether it were railroads or whoever, Standard Oil, back in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
And probably now as well as then, investigative journalism is going to play a role, and that leads me to a segue. You were, until recently, the news editor at The Village Voice, launched in 1955, the first alternative news weekly. The Village Voice has ceased publication, and that has a lot of meaning for some of us, you know. I just like to ask you, certainly it changed over its history, certainly it means different things to different people. What did The Village Voice mean for you, and what do you think its closure means for the city?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the same way there is in a lot of things these days, especially in New York, about, well, you know, The Voice wasn't what it used to be anyway. You know, what in journalism is right now. I, you know, had written for The Voice for 20 years and had been editor there the last couple. You know, one of the things that I really realized the more time I spent working on The Voice was the special role that it really had to play in terms of being a real alternative to the corporate media and, you know, some of what you see in other outlets. It, you know, really was sort of the predecessor of a lot of the sort of bloggy things like, you know, like Gothamist, for example, which does a great job. But The Voice really had an ability and sort of an ethos of trying to be both the funniest and wittiest people in the room and also the smartest and the most serious about the journalism. I think it's something that, you know, I'd like to think that we carried out until the bitter end. And I'm obviously writing for other places as well right now, and other people who, you know, contribute to The Voice are going to continue to do that too. But I hope that there will still be room for that kind of journalism in the world, you know, stuff that makes us laugh, but at the same time, stuff that really does the best of what investigative journalism is supposed to do, not just giant articles trying to win Pulitzers, but really exposing the dynamics of power and exposing what we need to do in order to change our world for the better. So I am very sad to see The Voice go, not just as a staffer and as a writer, but as a reader of it. And I hope that people who are thinking of journalistic endeavors in the future try and find a way to make that sort of project work again, because I think it's what we still very much need.
We've been speaking with Neil DeMoss. His latest book is The Brooklyn Wars, and you can find his article, What Can Be Done to Stop Amazon from Devouring Everything, online at Gothamist.com. Neil DeMoss, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to my third encounter with Dr. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. Tim is an atmospheric scientist. He's studying one of the big unknowns of our future climate, the behavior of clouds. Garrett also publishes papers on what I will call the physics of large-scale economy. He says civilization is a heat engine, and believe me, that is a rabbit hole where even confirmed preppers should shiver a bit. Let's explore the clouds, the climate, and the Arctic with a side order of inevitable collapse. Tim Garrett, welcome back to the eclectic airspace known as Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex.
I like talking with you, Tim, and I found a good index to your recent work linked in tweets at a place called @dissipativesys. Is that name because we inhabit a dissipative system?
Very much so. I actually changed the name to Nephologue, Nephologue, if anyone is interested. And yes, it is based on the idea that everything that we identify in the universe in some way or another is a dissipative system. And what I mean by that is that it consumes energy from its environment, high potential energy, and has internal circulations within it. And then it converts that energy into unavailable, low potential energy. That energy may be available to something else, but that is really the means by which any system exists and evolves and grows and ultimately shrinks.
September 10th, your tweet, quote, "Arctic air pollution already high, but it's not super clear whether it will increase or decrease." And you reference New Science published September 3rd, 2018 in the AGU journal Earth's Future. Tell us why the picture there is still unclear.
The Arctic's quite an interesting place. I've been working a lot, even since I was, I guess, a graduate student, on how pollution from mid-latitudes might be affecting clouds in the Arctic, clouds in particular. And there's something where we might think that the Arctic is really should be a pristine place because so few people live up there. But the fact is that air from mid-latitudes, where most people live, tends to be polluted. There's also forest fires, and this pollution, this aerosol pollution, blows northwards and has the capacity to affect the Arctic in many ways. One is to be deposited on snow and make it darker, and another is to change cloud properties in the Arctic. And it turns out that the Arctic is unusually sensitive to this pollution. The clouds, we found differences of as much as a factor of 7 times more sensitive to the pollution than clouds at lower latitudes. And there's 2 things that could go on here. As the climate warms, we are very concerned about how the Arctic will change, since the Arctic seems to be changing about twice as rapidly, measured by temperature, as the rest of the world, taken as a whole. And there's 2 things that might happen here. One is that the aerosol pollution could increase due to increased industrialization in the Arctic as shipping lanes open up, so for example, and then the Arctic warms and becomes more habitable. And that might change clouds in a way that both warms and cools the Arctic, depending on the season. But also as the Arctic warms up, it's going to become wetter. And if it becomes wetter, there will probably be more rain. And if there is more rain, that could act to clean up the Arctic by scavenging the pollution from the air. And we know just from experience that often if the air is polluted, along comes a rainstorm and things clean up. Well, the same thing could happen in the Arctic. It could go from quite a polluted place at times to something far cleaner. So there's big questions in that way. And it's an interesting problem.
Yes, you co-authored another paper with Q. Koopman about this Arctic pollution. That was in November 2017 in Geophysical Research Letters. And to me, that paper is a big deal. First, We know that Arctic ecosystems at ground level are sensitive. They're even fragile. Why do you say in the Arctic the clouds are also fragile? They're right at the edge of their existence.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it, right at the edge of their existence. They barely form. I mean, the atmosphere in the Arctic tends to be quite quiet. They do get storms, but for the most part, the atmosphere is what we would call stable, which means you don't tend to see big puffy cumulus clouds forming in the Arctic. It tends to be this very shallow stratus clouds, and they can be just maybe a few tens of meters thick. And so they're just barely there. You know, it could be clear, it could be cloudy. And it turns out if the air is polluted due to pollution emissions, say, from Europe, that can change the cloud properties by quite a lot. I mean, the main way it changes them is to make the droplets in the clouds smaller. One surprising thing might be for most people that even though the Arctic is well below the freezing point, clouds can tend to be made of liquid nonetheless, down to quite low temperatures of, you know, minus 20 degrees Celsius. And they do change to ice. We just had a paper accepted in Geophysical Research Letters which showed that the pollution seems to make it much more likely that the clouds will switch from liquid to ice in the Arctic. So what happens is the pollution comes along. Something about the pollution is enabling those liquid droplets to switch to ice crystals. And when they turn to ice crystals, they tend to precipitate. They form a delicate snow. And that can change the lifetimes of the clouds. Now, how that will affect the climate is uncertain because the Arctic climate system, like any climate system, is complicated. There are many feedbacks back and forth. But this is an important ingredient to the problem, we think. The pollution from the mid-latitudes is disturbing the Arctic environment in surprising ways.
Are clouds in the Arctic important to the global climate system?
That's an excellent question. I don't know. You can imagine ways that they would be. So one area that I've been working hard on is trying to show how the clouds tend to cool the climate in the Arctic in the summer when they are perturbed by aerosols. And then this aerosol perturbation tends to warm the Arctic surface in the winter. Now, how that translates to changes at mid-latitudes is not so well known, although there are people, scientists like Jennifer Francis, who are arguing that the rapid Arctic warming is having profound effects on the temperatures at winter in places like the United States. And this is highly contentious. I'm not an expert on it myself, but there are many people who are arguing that the Arctic is not isolated from where most of us live, but rather it can have its changes, can have substantial effects on the climate at mid-latitudes.
You know, we just went through a second or third summer of almost being burned down here and living in wildfire smoke. And the September 2018 study that you referenced by Jay Schmall found, quote, in the summer, boreal forest fires cause high levels of atmospheric pollution. But if I read your work correctly, you seem to say that wildfire smoke did not contribute to the formation of Arctic clouds.
That was one of the surprising results. Yes, there is a lot of forest fire smoke in the Arctic. I have seen it in my own eyes. I was aboard an airplane once in the Arctic for a field program. We were up at the North Slope of Alaska for 6 weeks, and we were flying through clouds and then the atmosphere, and sometimes it would look like we were in the smog of Los Angeles. And I didn't know at that time, because this was back in the 90s, where that smog layer came from. But now I think there's a realization that at levels like, let's say, 5 kilometers above the surface, these smog layers are due to forest fires. And they just get up there and then they hang around for a long time. So these are quite common. However, what happens is that these aerosols, levels from the forest fires tend not to be at the same levels that the clouds are at. So one way of imagining it might be that that air that is polluted was originally hot and dry. That's why there were forest fires, and the forest fires are convective. They create upward motions because they're hot, and that takes the aerosols to places that aren't favorable for forming clouds. So the major thing we found was that the pollution that is affecting clouds in the Arctic tends to be what we would call anthropogenic pollution, human-made pollution.
And is that human-made pollution that arrives in the Arctic? And we know it is because Jason Bock showed us gray glaciers in Greenland just from the landing of all those aerosol particles. But is it dealing with what I would say global pollution, a sort of widely dispersed level pollution, or do local sources matter more when we're talking about clouds?
When we talk about local sources, I guess there are two ways you could refer to it. Local sources in the Arctic have an outsized impact on the Arctic. They're just there, so they're in the right place at the right time. Local sources at mid-latitudes can also have a profound effect on the Arctic because there are atmospheric air motions that naturally take plumes of aerosol pollution from places like Europe and increasingly Asia to the Arctic along transport pathways that directly take the aerosols to the Arctic without a great deal of dilution. The global aerosol level is actually, on average, fairly uniform because of this reason that precipitation is everywhere and it tends to remove pollution from the atmosphere. So there is a background aerosol level in the globe as a whole, and it does go up and down a bit depending on the global pollution levels, but that is not the major driving force for change in the Arctic. It tends to be these narrowly focused plumes that come from specific pollution sources like factories or smelters or even just general people going back and forth to work.
We want to know how Arctic clouds function in a global climate model. You and your colleagues have new science to help answer that question more simply. Please tell us about your paper published in the Journal of Geophysical Research in July 2018.
And this is the work that I'm particularly excited by right now. I think increasingly when we are thinking about forecasting future climate, there's growing recognition that the biggest unknown, and I don't think I'm exaggerating here, in whether the degree of climate change that we will see for a given amount of carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere is how clouds will respond to a change in climate. So the issue here is that we have forcings and feedbacks. So the forcings of climate change are the basic greenhouse gases. The dominant one here that is driving the change is carbon dioxide, of course. But then there are feedbacks, which are that as the carbon dioxide concentrations go up, temperatures go up, and then the water vapor concentration will tend to increase. And water vapor is a very strong greenhouse gas. It's the dominant greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. So when we talk about climate change, it's actually more about the water vapor than the CO2. Even if the CO2 is a trigger, the water vapor is a bullet. And that's a positive feedback. And there are other feedbacks, too, related to how the atmospheric temperature structure will change, and also just that, like the element on your stovetop, a hotter planet will emit more efficiently infrared radiation to the atmosphere. It will cool down more efficiently. So that's negative feedback. Then there's clouds. And so clouds are the hard thing to do because they are incredibly complicated. I mean, in terms of complication, they are really, I think, the most complicated natural phenomenon on our planet, with the exception of perhaps volcanoes, which are more sporadic. But just as normal things, the clouds are incredibly energy dense. They consume massive amounts of energy due to latent heat release from condensation. And that creates an extraordinary range of phenomena. I mean, ranging from every snowflake being different, created by a cloud, to the turbulent motions of the cloud spanning scales from millimeters to kilometers, and that the clouds themselves can span hundreds of kilometers in storm tracks. And representing this variability in the climate model is almost impossible, because the climate models have grid boxes that may be tens of kilometers on each side, and they just don't have the resolution to pick out the small-scale cloud processes. Now, people try to, what they say is, parameterize this, but the parameterizations are themselves very uncertain, and it's almost like a Pandora's box. Every time we narrow down one process, we reveal smaller-scale processes that are themselves uncertain. So the climate models right now seem to suggest that clouds will amplify climate change by a considerable degree. So if we expect water vapor to have one effect, then clouds will add to that, and they will make the planet warmer. The challenge is constraining that, and we haven't been very successful at constraining how much clouds will warm the climate. It's really, really uncertain. So I thought, well, maybe there's a totally different way to come about this problem. And I tried to solve the problem of cloud sizes and distributions using basic thermodynamics. And what I found, what described in this paper, is that we can actually describe the numbers and shapes and sizes of clouds in an incredibly complex tropical cloud field to an extremely high degree of accuracy using just a few lines of physics rather than using an incredibly complicated cloud model. So there's cloud models that are at very high resolution. And I found that I could reproduce the statistics for cloud sizes within a cloud model of 1 billion grid points run every 2 seconds in a massive supercomputer. I think it was 300,000 processor hours in this supercomputer simulation. It was possible to reproduce a representation of a cloud field in that simulation accurately to within 13% using just a little bit of physics. And that's, I think, important because it dramatically simplifies the problem. It shows that we can reduce the cloud problem effectively to a point. All we need to know is the stability of the atmosphere. And if we know the stability of the atmosphere, which is quite predictable, then we can unravel statistically an entire tropical cloud field. We can show, we don't know which cloud where might look like Mickey Mouse, but we can say that statistically we will have a certain number of big clouds and a much larger number of small clouds, and that this obeys statistical properties that are simple to describe mathematically and are simple to predict.
All right, I got to get back to my original ask. What will happen to Arctic clouds as the planet warms 1, 2, or 4 degrees C?
I think that the prediction is that cloud cover will increase. So as the sea ice melts in the Arctic, then the exposure to the ocean will increase, and so the atmosphere will become more unstable because there is moisture and heat that's coming from the ocean, and that will naturally lend itself to an increase in cloud cover. And these clouds will tend to act as a blanket, and the prediction is that these clouds will tend to, on average, warm the surface, and in a way leading to a positive feedback that accelerates sea ice loss, because the clouds basically act as a blanket for the surface and warm it and then lead to more clouds.
Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Tim Garrett, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. Tim, let's get our head out of the clouds for a minute. You argue our current civilization will collapse sooner or later. In a four-minute Vimeo, you conclude something has to give. What doesn't add up for you?
Well, it's interesting you say get heads out of the clouds, because I think actually there are incredible parallels between civilization and clouds. These are complex systems that consume a lot of energy, that grow explosively into their by consuming energy from their environment and matter from their environment, and ultimately reach a point where they've consumed all that is available and die. And I think, you know, for clouds, we can see this all the time. For civilization, we are still in this explosive growth phase. So the point I am trying to make is that this explosive growth phase that we are in currently with our global economy for civilization as a whole is based upon consuming energy and matter from our environment. That is what keeps all the circulations going. If we did not consume energy from our environment, all of civilization would grind to a halt. We would die out of starvation, and our concept of a global economy would die with us. But that's not what's happening now. Right now, we are discovering new energy resources at quite a rapid rate in one way or another, whether it's renewables or fossil fuels or whatever it is, not even shale oils. It's a substantial source of energy. And that's enabling civilization to grow extremely rapidly. But there is a consequence to this. Growth cannot be sustained forever. It's simply impossible. Eventually, the sources of energy will be depleted. I mean, just to take as an example, it's a simple calculation. We will consume as much energy and raw materials from our environment in the next 30 years as we have since 1750. That's an incredible number. I mean, we are going to double civilization over again in the next 30 years over what we have in the past 250. And this is just a consequence of exponential growth. And in 30 years, our energy demands and raw material demands will be twice what they are today at current rates of growth. And then you think, well, that's just 30 years. What's 30 years beyond that? Again, that would be a quadrupling. And so, you know, maybe we can do that. I don't know. There's lots of unpredictable things out there. It seems in some sense impossible because our environment is already starting to groan under the burden of our consumption. Perhaps there's a means to continue this growth, but growth necessitates an accelerating rate of production of waste products, and there's a variety of waste products that we are increasingly swimming in. One of these is, of course, carbon dioxide, which leads to climate change, and there's other things too, like topsoil depletion and nitrification of our waterways, depletion of fish stocks in the ocean. The waste products of our consumption are going to accelerate. And so when I say something has to give, I think we are left in a very difficult position. If civilization does not start to collapse very soon, and the growth stalls and then not just stalls, but then civilization enters into a profound decline. If civilization does not do that, then it may be forced into that decline under either the burden of its consumption of resources or under the burden of the waste products it has produced, either due to climate change or a deteriorating environment. And this is probably going to happen quite rapidly, because we are not talking about centuries here. We are talking about decades.
In a tweet that you posted August 15th, you linked to a New York Times article where even climate-aware Germany still depends on coal for up to 40% of its energy. And you say, historically, new energy sources add to the mix rather than replace their older foundation. That sounds pretty bleak for the future of green energy like solar and wind. That's not what we're all dreaming about.
Yeah, I mean, we would like to think that solar and wind might replace coal, but if you think about it, if nothing else, historically that has not been the case. Our consumption of various energy sources, it does go up and down over time. But in general, we have been introducing new energy sources, and these tend to be additive. So you think at one point in the distant past, we consumed much less energy, and then our primary source of energy would have been wood. And then we added coal, and then we added oil, and then we added natural gas and nuclear, and now we're adding renewables. And it's not that the total energy consumption is stabilizing or going down. It is continuing to increase with each addition. It's like we add a new degree of freedom in the system. And civilization is not made of energy. It's made of matter. We use this energy from the renewables to build more of civilization. And then when you build more of civilization by consuming raw materials, using energy to consume raw materials from the environment, and convert it into civilization, civilization grows. When civilization grows, its demands for energy of all types increases, not just for renewables, but of all types. And so there is no obvious link between adding new energy sources, new types of energy, and a reduction in old energy sources. It just simply enables us to do more. So myself, I don't think about wind and solar as being particularly green. They are sources of energy. Our civilization is not made of energy. It is made of matter. We use energy to extract raw materials from our environment. If we add new energy sources, that will just enable us to rape the environment further. That's what we use the energy for. It is to extract raw materials in one way or another.
Well, as part of your analysis, I'm still burning wood, so that hasn't been replaced. We're still using the old systems, as you say. Now, in several places, you suggest we may revisit a system-wide depression like the 1930s. I'm not sure the 1930s is a good analysis or that we can reach any historical precedent from where we are now. I mean, maybe the 1930s will seem good or mild compared to a climate-ravaged future, or maybe humanity will squeeze into a brand new place. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, who's said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes? Yeah, of course, we can't return to the 1930s. I'm not a historian, but I think we can look back at various times in history and say when nations or regions or civilization as a whole even has been more resource constrained, and that competition for resources has increased, then the competition plays out in predictable ways. I mean, one of those ways, of course, is wars, and other ways is inflation. I would not be surprised to see more of a fragmentation of civilization in the future as we have increased resource scarcity. Right now, we're at a point where we are growing more rapidly than we ever have before, but that rate of growth has stagnated, and that was something that happened in the 1930s. It wasn't that the rate of growth was comparable to today, but it stagnated, and I think what that means is in a capitalist society that is predicated upon growth, there is competition for growth among countries, perhaps. So that if one country grows faster, then that necessarily means that another country must grow more slowly. And, of course, that means winners and losers, and nobody wants to be the loser.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. Now, I did discover that you have a blog called Nephilog, as you say. Does nephrolog mean something?
Oh, it's a totally silly name, but nephology is a 19th century word for the study of clouds. And I find it amusing that cloud physicists like myself almost uniformly have never heard of this word. So it's slightly ironic that those who practice a profession don't know what their profession is called. So I'm, I guess, whimsically trying to resurrect the word nephology, and I just called it a nephalog, you know, as in a monologue, but a nephalog. I don't know. I think of clouds when I think of these problems related to, let's say, civilization growth, because I see commonalities between all what I would say thermodynamically open systems and how they behave, and I have some sense of how clouds work, and I try to think about how that might relate to, let's say, civilization growth, another thermodynamically open complex system.
Well, one of your blogs this summer really stimulated my brain activity because you related brain activity to the global economy. Are you suggesting that we have a previously uncatalogued sensory system in human brains that know value and know how economic transactions must work?
Yeah, this is a fascinating question. There seems to be a collective perception of how much things are worth. And one thing I have tried to establish is that the global wealth of civilization, its, I guess, total value, is fundamentally tied to its rate of energy consumption. And that sort of poses the question of, well, how is it that we as humans at a very individual level can have some sort of conception of the value of things when we really are, the entirety of civilization is far too large for us to comprehend in any meaningful way. And here I think there is, again, some basic physics. It's the same physics that I would think of with respect to clouds. There's a concept that is called scale invariance or self-similarity, which is the idea that for a great, great many systems, as you see this everywhere in nature, whatever scale you look at, things look the same. So in the clouds, one way that this shows up is that if you look at, you know, large turbulent motions or small turbulent motions in a cloud, they'll look exactly the same. You don't really know what scale you're looking at unless you were told ahead of time. In terms of us in the context of the global civilization, I think of our brains being energy-consuming thing on organisms, much like the entirety of civilization, what I think maybe one of your former guests, Nate Hagans, called a superorganism. And the consumption of energy by the entirety or by a small component exhibits similar behaviors physically. And the reason they exhibit similar behaviors and the small scales as well as the large scales is that the small scales are connected to the large scales through energy transfers. Now, I know that sounds very abstract, but here's the basic idea. If you think about your daily life, you are connected to everybody else on this planet by a very small degree of number of degrees of separation. I could connect you to a distant Papua New Guinea's tribesman probably relatively quickly in, I would guess, perhaps 6 degrees of separation. Perhaps you know somebody who has been to Australia, who met somebody in Australia, who traveled to Port Moresby for work, who met a tribesman who was coming to Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea, to get some luxury goods, who then went back to his tribe in the distant highlands. And it wouldn't be too far to make that connection. And all of this involves a transfer of energy and information back and forth between all of us. So I think of us as being a vibrating whole that consumes energy, where everybody's connected at the whole and at the local level in fundamental ways. And it is through these connections that we collectively establish some sense of the worth of any given item.
I do worry that this line of reasoning may be trapped within glasses made from physics and math and see everything through that lens. I mean, for example, take a dream. Do we care what energy the brain and the rest of the body may be burning during a dream? We can't measure that energy in the sleeper and think we understand the dream. And I'll raise one second case. You're talking about a physics-based formula to relate climate, energy, and the economy, and your language suggests human civilization is almost like a cell, and we inject energy like a sugar, and the cell grows. But there's also things like ideas. I mean, without Einstein, we wouldn't be where we are, so there's the role of innovation. There's things other than energy and matter going on in this human system is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that's a tempting perspective. Of course, I'm seeing things through the lens of physics because I believe that physics does underlie everything in the universe and it does lend itself to also testable hypotheses. And I do test these hypotheses to try to see if they can make meaningful predictions. So, I mean, that's one advantage of using physics is that it's theoretically based and it can lead to things that can potentially be disproved. But let's say you'd mention Einstein and his ideas. Einstein's ideas required energy consumption. The brain is a very energy-hungry organism. For most of us, it consumes about 20 or 25 watts. It's about 20 to 25% of the consumption of the human as a whole. Neuronal oscillations, the frequency of neuronal firing within the brain, follows the same laws of self-similarity or scale invariance that you see, let's say, in income distributions in humanity or in the size of turbulent eddies in a cloud or like the impacts of meteors, the size of on the moon or a whole number of phenomena throughout the world. Our brains aren't actually fundamentally, at least statistically, all that different. And Einstein himself, he grew up in a wealthy society which could support the development of these ideas, that could feed him and provide the sort of intellectual stimulation that would lead to him to coming up with these fantastic conceptions of how the universe works. All of that would require energy. So you could think of Einstein as being in some way an extreme manifestation at the tail end of the spectrum of what a civilization produces. It's all part of a global whole where individual phenomena, like Einstein, are unpredictable at the individual level, but can be expected. We can expect wonderful ideas to come up in a wealthy civilization. And in an energy-constrained civilization where everybody is scrambling for their next meal, I think you would expect these to be less common.
And I loved this comment that you posted August 20th in the blog. You said, unlike enhancing our sense of well-being and social survival by storing crops to prepare for the winter, a response embedded within us from eons of evolution, there is no obvious precedent for a similar response to climate change, so we focus on contemporary issues that are much too short to relieve us from our predicament. And I think you just explained our mass fascination with the Donald Trump show while our world heats up so dangerously.
Yeah, I mean, I think economists talk about this, which is that we do value things in the short run more than those in the long run. You know, I'm not an expert in human behavior, of course, but it is interesting that we can plan for the future, but we seem to plan most effectively for futures that we have experienced previously. So we can plan for retirement because it's built into our society's understanding that you need to do this because plenty of other people have planned for retirement in the past. And we model our retirement savings on what other people have experienced. We naturally plan for storing crops for the winter because if there wasn't a history of doing so, well, we wouldn't be here today. Climate change seems different. You know, it's not it's not the same. I mean, what's the collective memory that we have of a similar event? I don't think we have it.
Maybe somewhere in our brains there was the arrival of the ice in the ice ages, and we all had to move south or change what we were eating. But that's not the same at all, is it?
Yeah, it's rather a long time ago. I mean, I don't feel I have in my thinking some sort of built-in planning for a future ice age. And maybe the reason is that these climate changes in the past tended to happen over sufficiently long periods of time that still, I mean, relative to the lifespan of a human, that still the dominant thing anybody would ever think of would be planning for the winter, not planning for temperatures being a couple degrees colder 100 years from now.
Well, I've just been reading that our homes are totally designed for the cold, and we're trying to keep the cold out and use insulation and so on, and not for the heat. So we've misdesigned our houses for the future that is developing.
Yep. Well, I just mortgaged my house to buy some land up at 8,800 feet in the mountains nearby. So that's my future refrigerator.
Wow. Okay. Well, now, one last point on the economic front. You attribute what I call, or what many call, the great acceleration after 1950 to increased energy availability. But then I ask myself, well, what if the economy crashes due to war or human misunderstanding or just plain greed, and there could be no direct relationship to energy availability at all?
Well, I don't think history bears that out. Again, I'm not a historian, but look, if everybody's doing well and there's a ton of energy out there and everybody can grow successfully, is there really that much of a need to be killing one another? I don't see that. I see that, you know, wars tend to crop out when there is for a competition for resources. And, you know, we've been in a period of extraordinary wealth since 1950 because of this of flourishing discoveries of things like oil and natural gas. And eventually that will come to a halt. So it's not until then that myself personally, I would expect that things like wars and inflation would rear their head. I mean, it will happen. These resource scarcity issues will happen. I mean, it can happen in two ways. One is that we run out of the raw materials, or another is that they just become much more difficult to access, even if they are out there, because things like climate change start to become such a burden that it destroys the infrastructure that we have and use to access those resources. So, I mean, resource scarcity is a question of availability. We can deplete, we can make things less available by depleting it. We can also make things less available by a fraying of the fabric of civilization that is used to access those resources, and that can happen by way of environmental destruction. And it's at that point that I would expect things like wars to become increasingly common. But we've seen a trend since the 50s of decreasing deaths from wars, so it doesn't.
You're right, historically. I mean, Japan went to war after they were surrounded by the American Navy and cut off from the energy supplies they needed for their new economy. And Germany similarly wanted to invade Russia in order to get at the Balkans oil because their economy needed more energy. So I guess it does hold up. But it, to your point you just made, beyond science and philosophy, it looks to me like billions of humans are headed into a great time of suffering. I don't know if that's in this decade or the next, but by, say, 2050, for a number of reasons. Would you share that?
Yeah. I mean, of course, there's suffering at all times. And I think it's many people today are suffering incredibly. I mean, you just look at a place like Syria. And I think the question is whether things like Syria or Venezuela will become increasingly common in the future. And, yeah, I mean, I do expect that to happen. I mean, you and I, we live in extraordinarily rich countries. They may be able to insulate themselves for a time, but the United States and Canada are connected to the rest of the world. We aren't isolated. We are connected through international trade, and everybody wants to live somewhere. There's refugees looking for somewhere to live. One thing that you see in systems growth is when something's growing incredibly rapidly, I would use the word super exponential growth or explosive growth. So it's not just that there is growing exponentially with a constant rate of return, but the rate of return itself is increasing with time. And that's the situation we've been in since 1950. When you see explosive growth, you tend to see that followed by explosive collapse when the conditions that supported that explosive growth are no longer there. So, you know, when we talk about the future and there being a fraying or a decline or whatever it is, I think of there being two modes of decline. One is a gradual decline, like civilization does subside, but it does so gradually in a maybe arguably fairly ordered fashion. And the other is a super exponential decline, where the rate of decline itself accelerates, and that would be a collapse. So maybe an analog is just to think about an ocean wave. You could think of an ocean wave moving up and down, maybe us like a cork on that wave moving up and down, and it would move up gradually and come down gradually. Or you could also have a situation where that wave explodes upwards as it approaches the beach, and then ultimately when it runs out of water, it collapses, it crashes on the beach. I suspect, I hate to think of this that way, but I suspect that based on civilization's recent past, we are more like that wave approaching the beach than like a wave that will subside and perhaps rise again out in the middle of the ocean.
Jim Garrett, if we are all part of a superorganism following inexorable laws of physics, does it matter what any of us does or whether we fear the future or enjoy the present?
I mean, I can tell you my own feeling, and I guess that's what you're asking. I have a family, I have friends, I'm concerned about the state of the world, and I truly want to believe that, you know, there is the capacity for individuals to make a difference in the ultimate trajectory of civilization. And I'll admit that myself, I struggle to reconcile that with what I see with testable hypotheses based on fundamental physics, which suggests that ultimately, and in a statistical fashion, one way or another, civilization is on a trajectory, and us as individuals cannot change that trajectory because it is determined by things that are beyond us, such as just simply the geology of the planet, whether or not the energy reserves that feed civilization are out there. I suspect this superorganism idea is really correct. Civilization is a superorganism that will grow into the resources that sustain it, like cells in a petri dish, until it can't. And then it will grow to the maximum extent possible until no further growth is possible. And then the collapse will start to happen.
Isn't that what stars do?
Well, everything does this. Now, yes, this is what stars do, but everything in the universe is a consequence of an initial availability of energy and matter. That's what created it in the first place, and that energy and matter had to come from somewhere. And when that energy and matter runs out, the thing can no longer sustain its internal circulations, and it dies.
So, Tim, are you thinking all the time? Help us understand you.
Oh, I drink beer. You know, that helps.
Well, what I do is I garden, and I do put away food for the winter. I've just been doing that. I've been putting away squash and tomato sauces on my stove, thickening, and I've picked all the apples from my apple tree. And somehow those, I would say, age-old activities help soothe my brain from talking to scientists who upset my brain.
Yeah, we all have our coping techniques.
Definitely.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Does Tim Garrett know what is next for Tim Garrett? Do you know what you're going to be working on?
I'm totally fascinated by this cloud problem. You know, it's just, so I was working on the clouds, and I managed to finally break through, I think, in trying to come up with these statistical laws. And now so much seems so much more clear, like with so many situations. I was just teaching a class yesterday, and I found a paper from 2005 that was showing how this thing called power laws or self-similarity or scale invariance, you just see it absolutely everywhere. It's so fascinating. I mean, it's things like the frequency of words in Moby Dick perfectly follows a predictable power law, or wealth of people in civilization, or clouds or droplets, or the firing of neurons in the brain. They all follow the exact same mathematical law. And this has me fascinated, and I think I have some sort of understanding of why this is the case now. It's basically with a finite amount of energy and matter, everybody has to share. And it's like the line from the Bible, I'm probably paraphrasing, the poor are always with us. There will always be a few rich and many poor. And that's because everybody has to share. There will be more poor who have as much wealth collectively as the very few rich. And there's sort of a principle called equipartition here. The number times the wealth is invariant with the amount of wealth the person has. And so one question I have in my mind right now, thinking about the economy, is what will happen with income inequality in the future? We see rising income inequality right now. I suspect that's quite predictable. As the world gets richer, there will be the uber rich, and the poor are always with us. And there's going to be a continued expansion of that separation for as long as the world gets wealthier. And then I would expect a contraction, too, as the world gets, as competition for resources increases. And then you start thinking about, well, how would that play out in terms of, let's say, political systems? Do we have things like capitalism becoming no longer a viable option in a resource-constrained environment? I mean, it's just armchair philosophizing, of course, but it's based upon sort of thinking about how physical systems work and some sort of recognition that humanity itself behaves like a physical system.
As we wrap up, is there some place where we can find in one place that basic formula that you've just been talking about?
I just posted a tweet yesterday about it, about income distributions. I mean, there is the paper that's online about the clouds. I think, you know, for most listeners, perhaps even a lot of people in my field, it might be a bit esoteric. I'll put out a blog post. You've encouraged me now, as you have in the past, to write about these topics. I'll try to present a very simple explanation for this basic idea of scale invariance in economic systems. It's not that complicated, and I think it can be explained succinctly with words.
We will be looking for it. That is it for this journey into clouds and a cloudy future. We've been speaking with Dr. Tim Garrett, professor of atmospheric physics at the University of Utah. You can find links to the papers and the blogs and videos in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, talking with you, I do feel a little bit small compared to a larger man, so thank you so much for coming back.
Thanks so much, Alex. Every single time, it's been a great pleasure to talk with you. You're an excellent interviewer.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please don't forget to support Radio EcoShock. Help pay those bills. You can donate at our website at ecoshock.org or at our show blog at ecoshock.info. You can find Tim Garrett's Twitter feed at Nephologue, Nephologue. That's worth the trip, because each tweet leads to delicious and or disturbing places. I'll post links to my previous two interviews with Tim Garrett in my blog. Those interviews are still rich, still downloaded a couple of hundred times a month for years. In fact, you can use my site to explore conversations with hundreds of top climate scientists and authors. Please listen and pass it all on. Thanks to listener support, all my past shows and interviews are free anywhere in the world at ecoshock.org. I don't have more to say, and I don't want to muddy your thoughts from the deep places we have just been. Let me leave with this. As the Christmas consumer shopping extravaganza begins, here is a message from the Reverend Billy Talens and the Church of Stop Shopping Choir. Find them at revbilly.com, revbilly.com. Thank you for listening, and please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
Blessed are the consumers. You don't have to live your life with products. Amen. Blessed is the ordinary American citizen who holds onto a patch of public commons. Blessed are you. Blessed is the artist who is not corporate sponsored. You're the one who's going to teach us peace. Somebody give me a peace hallelujah today.
Blessed are you.
Blessed are you who confuse consumerism with freedom. You'll be delighted to discover the difference. Amen. Blessed are the advertisers. Blessed are the celebrities. You're waiting for the remarkable restfulness of honesty.
Blessed are you.
Blessed are the neighborhoods people flew from in fear. Your children shall reappear to illuminate the dark economy. Blessed are you. Blessed are the workers in the super malls, the towns, your employers killed shall come back to life. Amen.
Blessed
are you. And blessed is the breadwinner with outsourced dreams, sitting in his SUV in a traffic jam from Christmas hell. This year, a free gift shall set you free. Set you free. And blessed are the young women in the sweatshops for the things you make to fly you like magic evening gowns to the city of light. The city. Blessed are you who disturb the customer. You just might be loving your neighbor. are you who disturb the customer? You just might be loving your neighbor. Blessed are you, blessed are you, blessed are you. You're disturbing the customer. You're loving your neighbor.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The U.S. is exchanging tactics and methods with many countries around the world. I don't think there's any other example of such close connections between two countries like the U.S. and Israel.
They had absolutely no reason to search me since they were not going to let me enter. So it was for pure humiliation.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. We're back from a short summer hiatus, and we're just going to jump right in. Today, we'll be talking about U.S. and Israeli exchange programs to share practices of police militarization, mass surveillance, violent repression of communities and movements that both governments define as a threat, and racial profiling, and how this partnership encourages ongoing violations of human and civil rights. Then we'll hear from a Chicago-based Palestinian-American who has quite a story to tell about what happened when she tried to enter Ben-Gurion Airport and visit her family. She was able to actually record part of her interrogation by Israeli border officers, and we'll play that recording for you. But first, Jewish Voice for Peace and Researching the American-Israeli Alliance have just published a report called Deadly Exchange: The Dangerous Consequences of American Law Enforcement Trainings in Israel. It draws on research that Jewish Voice for Peace has been doing as part of its Deadly Exchange campaign to end collaborations between American and Israeli state forces and to highlight the harm those collaborations do to people fighting for their rights in Palestine and across the U.S. The report is the result of dozens of Freedom of Information Act requests, exclusive interviews with American and Israeli personnel, and exhaustive academic and media research in English, Arabic, and Hebrew. Accompanying the report, researching the American-Israeli Alliance released the Palestine Is Here database, which is a website mapping Israeli training of police forces from cities and towns across the U.S. Joining us to talk about these police exchanges and the report is Eran Efrati, Executive Director of Researching the American-Israeli Alliance and a board member of Jewish Voice for Peace. Eran, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about the report. What does the research tell us in terms of the depth of collaboration between U.S. and Israeli forces?
Well, it tells us, first of all, that Palestine is not a foreign policy issue anymore in the United States today, and that what we see in Palestine affects our police in the U.S. understand their role and carry out their work here back home. When Raya authored the report, we went back to 2002. And since 2002, just months after 9/11, hundreds of high-ranking officials from law enforcement here in the U.S. have been sent to training delegations in Israel, and thousands have been trained by Israeli security experts in the U.S. But it's not only police. FBI, CIA, ICE have also trained in Israel, but also employees of the MTA in New York and campus security from universities across the country, all of which went through the same training under the banner of counterterrorism. Now, of course, it's important for us in the report to notice that U.S. policing has colonial roots that both affect and draw on American operations across the world long before these exchanges began, from the Philippines and Vietnam and from slavery through the Jim Crow area and the Cohen mass incarceration area. You know, so U.S. policing as an arm of the state has always been oppressive. There's always been violent and racist. But with that said, in the current war on terror era, the refinement of tactics of suppression that happens through training with Israel is very important, and it cannot be undermined. What we try to argue in the report is that these trainings normalize and in some cases shape oppressive policing tactics that are based on what Israel does to an occupied population and then coming back home here to deal with civilians in the U.S. And these trainings go against, like you said, everything that civil rights and other activists and social movements have been working for in this country for decades.
Iran, you mentioned a little bit of the history of this collaboration, especially since September 11th, 17 years ago. Mm-hmm. But who are some of the organizations that sponsor these projects? I know that the Anti-Defamation League has been a main supporter of these exchanges. Can you talk about these organizations and their motives here?
Absolutely. I think it's a very interesting question because we see it as a state federal delegation that are being backed by the state, by the government, on all the branches of it. But de facto on the ground, they're being sponsored by small organizations, or not so small, but private organizations, NGOs, like the Anti-Defamation League, which is supposed to be a civil rights organization, like AIPAC or GILI from Georgia. Just private organizations that are invested enormous amounts of money in sending thousands of police officers throughout two decades already into Israel and to train. Now, when we look at the reason and the reasoning behind that, we can find a lot of answers. We can talk about the ADL or AIPAC need and want to have a clear connection between Israel and the U.S. and to strengthen the idea that Israel is the biggest ally of the U.S., so Zionist motives that are pushing the police to train there. But when you ask them directly, they say that they care about security and that there is a joint enemy that we need to face. Now, this discourse is a discourse of foreign policy. It's a discourse of a government that local NGOs takes and spend a lot of money in sending. Now, the question that we are still asking ourselves is, where is the real money coming from? How is the money being transferred through those NGOs and those organizations into these delegations, into Israel, and whose really interest is it the delegation will be there?
Iran, what are some of the common ways both the U.S. and Israel use state violence to crush protests, especially as we look at the way that the U.S. has militarized its forces and deployed them against Black Lives Matter protests in recent years? Mm-hmm. But of course, as you mentioned, as routine treatment by police of Black and brown people.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. I think that in many ways, Israel has modeled many of its state violence tactics on the American model. In the post-colonial era in the last around 70 years. And the U.S. has modeled the language and policing tactics in the post-9/11 era for sure on the self-proclaimed successful and proven Israel model. Both the U.S. and Israel are considered democracies by the West, but they've always deployed anti-democratic and violent tactics to crush social movements that have challenged the regime. It begins with mass surveillance on a giant scale, like we can learn from the NSA and obviously from the Israeli regime. It ends with first resort of violent crushing of protests. Israel uses brutal and often lethal force against Palestinian protests. We have seen this for years across the West Bank. We, of course, see it now on the Gaza border. In the U.S., cops shoot and kill Black and brown people with impunity for decades now. And we see more recently their use a force as the force resolved also in protest in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and other places. So you really see that the history between the countries, the long history of collaboration around security that goes back decades, but with specifically the 9/11 happening after the second Intifada started, with both Israeli and American officials said that are fighting the same Muslim enemy, the same terrorists, and then also the same security threats from within, the same idea of security threats for policemen or for terror from within. Israel was described as you know, after 9/11 as an expert that is filling a needed gap of how to create so-called security. And many in the U.S. governments were very openly interested in the Israeli model. The U.S. was also interested in how Israel managed to use so much force and anti-democratic measures against Palestinians and really control a whole population with no rights, but still remain de facto in the status of legitimacy and democracy. So when we're going back to how they're deploying the force, and I think that one of the things that maybe is not talked enough is that, yes, they're using lethal force on civilians or on people under their control, both Israel and the United States. But the question is how, at the end of the day, we can still call them democracy. What are they really sharing that they are not already both considered to be some kind of violent dictatorship like other countries around the world?
Iran, you mentioned control of populations. Can you talk about the ways that detention is used and the policies around detention that are being exchanged by the U.S. and Israel, and the connections that you see between the tearing apart of families at the U.S.-Mexico border and the ways that Israel has used the same tactics against Palestinian families?
Right, right. Well, I think, both the U.S. and Israel have long histories from their establishments, really, of detaining population and separating families. Israel, of course, systematically incarcerate Palestinians as a way to break down resistance to the occupation, including, of course, incarcerating children on a regular basis, on a daily basis. If you're going to East Jerusalem, I just came back from 2 months back home in Palestine. And I do a lot of work around East Jerusalem. I have a lot of friends there and work. I mean, the image of a child being detained, and when we're saying a child, just to be clear, we're talking about 5 years old, 6 years old, 10, 11, not only 18 or 19, what will be considered still a child here in the U.S., but this image is a daily routine image. And Israel is separating families as a means of breaking this resistance to the occupation or just the fabric of a community that is living under them on a systematic level. Now, the U.S. obviously have a long history of separating families as well. Today, the U.S. is a global leader in incarceration and destroying families and the social fabric of entire communities. But the idea of policing borders, specifically the way that Israel does it today, is based on a discourse of security and based explicitly on race. So when ICE and other law enforcement agents are brought to witness a live demonstration, really, of the Israeli model, they are seeing a country that has an apartheid system of laws and policing that is based on the separation of families and mass incarceration of entire communities. So when these ideas from the Israeli model are taken to their logical conclusion in the U.S., the result is policies like the Muslim ban or child separating from their parents at the border. I mean, we're not claiming in the report that because of these exchanges, this has happened. Again, the U.S. have a long history of abuse of human rights, civil rights, and separation of families. But you cannot ignore the idea when training with a military force that is busy daily with separating families and arresting children, that it will not normalize and shape the way that police or ICE is working here back in the U.S.
That's the voice of Eran Efrati. We're talking about a brand new report that was just released called Deadly Exchange, The Dangerous Consequences of American Law Enforcement Trainings in Israel. Iran, a major part of the research is not only how these forces are training each other, but how corporations are also cashing in. Can you talk about why you included corporate profiteering research in this report and why it's important to bring that out into the equation?
Well, in many ways, we didn't only include corporate profiting. I think that we highlighted as the pushing force behind those exchanges, really. At RIA, we believe that the real exchange that is being exposed now is the American-Israeli military industries that under the banner of security collaboration to identify and combat a joint enemy, actually fund, develop, test, and sell tactics, technologies, and weapons around the world. Israel is unique, again, in the way they are the only accepted democracy, I would say, and that hopefully increasingly is disappearing, that holds what is referred to often as a laboratory in their backyard. The West Bank is Jerusalem, of course, Gaza, a lab where Israel refined, test out their weapons, but also methods of control, physically, psychologically. Those tactics, technologies, and weapons tried on Palestinians, and then they're being sold around the world as battle-proven. The Israeli security industry has developed with a huge, huge support of the U.S. military aid. For years, the U.S. is sending military aid to Israel. In the past decade or so, the number was around $3 billion, or more than $3 billion a year. More than 26% of that from the U.S. military aid in the last 10 years was invested in Israel's own military industry. Israel was the only country in the world that had this agreement with the U.S. That, you know, more than 26% can be used on Israel's industry. But the military industries that Israel developed actually became pretty powerful in the last decade and a half or so. Powerful enough to start actually being, to show a competition and threat the U.S. military industry. The Obama administration in 2006 signed a new military aid agreement that will take effect in now in 2019 that actually changed the term of the agreement. So while Obama promised Israel $3.8 billion a year, and most of the people, supporters and critics, talked about the huge increase of money and how the U.S. is backing Israel fully, the more important issue seems to be a lost in the fine print of the agreement, and we didn't heard about that enough, and is that Israel, from the $38 billion that they're going to receive in the next decade, have to spend 100% of the aid in buying U.S. weapons and technology made by American military industry. No more support to the Israeli industry, only by proxy or collaboration between the companies, but 100% is going back to the American industry. And what this means is that U.S. military aid to Israel is mostly a way to increase profits to U.S. military corporation after their products are tested and refined on Palestinians. And that is a realization we hope that activists for justice in Palestine, but also activists for racial and economic justice in the country will address. In many ways, the problem starts here and ends here in the U.S. And like we said, Palestine is very much a domestic issue today in America, not a foreign policy one.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present independent journalist Joanne Wipajewski, who examines the privilege and entitlement Brett Kavanaugh learned at his elite prep school that carried over into his partisan political activism and legal career. Dee Parvez, global politics reporter with Think Progress, who assesses world reaction to President Trump's presence at this year's UN General Assembly, which provoked both anger and laughter. And Carolyn Lush, program manager with Bike New Haven, who explains how her city's public-private partnership-operated bike share program differs from other similar programs across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Nearly 400,000 people have died in South Sudan's five-year bloody civil war, according to a study by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, funded by the U.S. State Department. The level of carnage and death from disease is much higher than previous UN estimates. Although a power-sharing agreement was signed in September, Western observers fear the peace deal is in danger of falling apart at any time. The new study shows the level of carnage in South Sudan, the world's newest nation, rivals the death toll in the Syrian civil war. Over 4 million people in South Sudan were forced to flee their homes, and 1 million refugees have fled into neighboring Uganda. Moreover, 7 million people rely on humanitarian aid for their survival. Today, there are over 14,000 UN peacekeepers in the embattled nation at a cost of over $1 billion a year. A peace deal was signed in 2015, but collapsed in July 2016, forcing rebel leader Machar to flee to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The resumption of the war was followed by the bloodiest fighting of the conflict and repeated atrocities against civilians. In the nation of Jordan, psychologist Ala Farouk is now a self-proclaimed Muslim Democrat. He's dropped his former allegiance with the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood and now embraces women's and democratic rights. Farouk insists the era of political Islam is dead. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the psychologist is part of a growing movement of Islamic activists from Tunisia, the epicenter of the Arab Spring that spread to Jordan and Malaysia, embracing a new era of moderate politics. These activists express support for ethnic and religious minorities, as well as secular Muslims. Leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood are also advocating moderation and engagement in multi-party politics. This is seen as a dramatic change from the early 1990s, when the Brotherhood called for Sharia law and gender segregation on college campuses. Yet, when the Arab Spring erupted in Tunisia in 2011, Islamist leaders there called for a gender equality law and adopted a progressive constitution. In Southeast Asia, the Malaysian Islamic Youth Movement, founded by Brotherhood activists in the 1970s, are dropping the group's Islamist identity in favor of interfaith projects with Christians and Buddhists. When Cesar Chavez died in 1993, the United Farm Workers was at a low point, fighting against growers who refused to sign union contracts with farm workers who voted to join the UFW under California's Agricultural Labor Relations Act. At the time, farm workers' wages were falling in California, recalls Arturo Rodriguez, who succeeded Chavez as head of the UFW and succeeded in reforming the union's tactics to regain membership. Now Rodriguez, who is retiring, will be succeeded by Teresa Romero, a native of Mexico City. While union contract workers are now generally much higher than the minimum wage, the UFW and its new leader face a daunting challenge in trying to raise the income of farm workers. For several decades, corporate growers have been globalizing their operations, growing fruit and vegetables in many countries. At the same time, as trade agreements like NAFTA have displaced poor rural communities in Mexico and Central America, farmers have come to the U.S. looking for work and survival. Major growers are now increasing the number of H-2A temporary workers they bring into the U.S. with cheaper, less protected contract laborers. In response, the UFW is striving to sign contracts that represent both long-term resident farm workers and guest workers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The testimony of Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's Supreme Court nominee before the Senate Judiciary Committee on September 27th, was a study in contrasts. Where Dr. Ford calmly and confidently recounted the night she says that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her at a high school party in 1982, Kavanaugh was alternately weepy and belligerent, charging that a left-wing conspiracy was out to destroy his life. Apart from multiple accusations of sexual assault, Kavanaugh's conduct at his confirmation hearing has raised serious questions about his honesty and temperament, qualities deemed critical in selecting a Supreme Court justice who's given a lifetime appointment. with GOP Arizona Senator Jeff Flake's demand for an FBI investigation into Dr. Ford's and other sexual assault allegations made against Kavanaugh. The Republican-controlled Senate was forced to delay a final vote on his confirmation. Your reporter spoke with independent journalist Joanne Wipajewski, who talks about her recent article titled, What Brett Kavanaugh Really Learned in High School, Make the Rules, Break the Rules, and Prosper, which examines the privilege and entitlement Brett Kavanaugh took with him from his elite prep school to his partisan political activism and legal career.
Now, we continue to be in this situation where people are saying, well, I believe her, I believe him. And I certainly believe her a whole lot more than I did before those hearings, and I find him even more unqualified to be justice on the Supreme Court than I had before. And really, even if he is completely innocent, I think his behavior at the hearings, a figure unhinged, a figure of tremendous self-importance and self-regard, a bully, a highly, highly partisan individual, a person who is dismissive of women, who was angry. You expect him to be angry. He would be inhuman if he wasn't angry. But the vitriol with which he spewed his conspiracy theories and with which his responses to the questions, the way he didn't answer questions, the way he was evasive, and the way he flat out lied. And now I think that's how he ought to be judged. And I think this Senate hearing was set up to say, do we believe her? Do we believe him? There was no evidence put into the record there. It was not a court. It was not a trial. It was, as they kept saying, a job interview. And I really think after that performance, who would hire such a figure?
You took Brett Kavanaugh's high school experience and really fast-forwarded to his work in the George W. Bush administration, working on issues such as torture that was authorized by the Bush administration in the aftermath of 9/11.
So here's a guy, he's in high school. He's with a lot of kids who are privileged to be in that school. Most of them are upper middle class or better. He is part of a world of, you know, his father's a lobbyist, his mother's a judge. A lot of people jump off from that school into higher realms. But really, they're young, they're drunk, they're breaking the law, right? These kids, by the many stories we've heard in the press, they rented beach houses out in Maryland. They ripped those beach houses up. They destroyed the houses of their friends. Nobody was sent to jail. Brett Kavanaugh was, in his yearbook, he says he was a member of the Rehoboth Beach Police Fan Club. The police would regularly come to these houses, tell them to knock it off, tell them to quiet down. They didn't have to ever pay for anything they did. So you get that sense, if you're a kid and you can break the rules, and then you go to college that tells you that you're special, you're among, that you're going to be part of the ruling class, that you're there because you are the very best, and you know you're the very best, and you know there's no accountability for your actions at all. This is what you hear your whole life. This is what's impressed upon you your whole life. Then you get into the White House, and you're with a lot of people who are saying, it doesn't matter if we break the law. It doesn't matter if we pay attention to international law. It doesn't matter if we arrest people who are Muslims in Afghanistan and we're going to put them in a prison in Cuba, Guantanamo. We're going to send them to black sites all over the place. We're going to torture them. We're going to ignore our international commitments. We're going to ignore everything. We can do it because we're the bully on the block. And I think these kids were bullies on the block when they were youths. And I think they got used to lying, and I think they got used to having their way. And what's so clear about Brett Kavanaugh is he dissembled or outright lied to Congress about his participation in at least one discussion of the torture program, the detention program without, you know, the end of habeas corpus that was going on in the Bush administration. He dissembled or outright lied about other things, you know, whether he got documents that belonged to the Democrats. He was not truthful in all his testimony during those hearings. So he has a record. You know, between what he said and what Blasey Ford said, she was much more credible than he was. But he has a record of dissembling and evasion. And he has a record of being someone who thinks the rules don't apply to him and don't apply to his class and his group. The fact that he signed on to a case that was whether Titan and Kachi, which are private contractors that supplied interrogators and translators to the U.S. government to work in black sites and in Abu Ghraib prison. And he signed on to the decision there saying that the people who were victimized, who were tortured by these contractors in Iraq, couldn't sue for civil liability, couldn't sue Titan and Kachi. And the decision he signed on to was so obscure and so remote, and basically just saying that we have to protect Titan and Kachi, we have to protect these corporations. And you completely forget what the subject is once you as you're reading this tortured prose, sorry for the word, but until you get to Merrick Garland, of all people, his dissent in the same case. And there in the center, at the very front of his dissent, is the human person, you know, beaten, blinded, humiliated, strung up, shocked, raped, forced to watch his father die, extinguished. That's what you get from Merrick Garland. From Brett Kavanaugh, you get the sense that how do we set the rules to get the rich guys off? But it did get back to your question about high school, in that one of the things that was so striking about his performance at the Senate was his absolute sense that he'd been denied something he deserves by right. This incredible entitlement. And, you know, we hear this word a lot, but that's what really came through for me watching the hearings, was how enraged he was, mostly for himself, how his humanity didn't seem to extend much beyond himself, and how his interests fundamentally were about his having gone to the right school, him having worked his tail off, worked, how he deserves this moment. And, you know, nobody deserves to be on the Supreme Court, and certainly no one who probably was a blackout drunk in high school.
That was independent journalist Joanne Wipajewski, co-editor of the book Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence. Find a link to her article titled What Brett Kavanaugh Really Learned in High School, Make the Rules, Break the Rules, and Prosper, and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In September 2017, when U.S. President Donald Trump first addressed the annual meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, he threatened to totally destroy North Korea and attacked a number of U.S. adversaries across the globe. Trump's caustic remarks were no surprise to world leaders, who'd observed this president's strange and disturbing behavior since he was sworn into office in January 2017. In his second address before the UN General Assembly this year, on September 25th, Trump spoke about his rejection of globalism, a reference to the UN's multilateral approach of bringing nations together to address global crises. Instead, Trump promoted his own vague brand of patriotism, known to his political base by the slogan America First. At the UN, Trump was characteristically antagonistic to friend and foe alike, with threats to impose new tariffs and sanctions as part of his current trade war. The president's accusations against China for what he claimed were plans to subvert the upcoming U.S. midterm congressional election were met with anger and derision. When Trump addressed the UN Security Council about his decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Iran nuclear agreement, virtually all nations present rejected Trump's position and spoke of their support for the Iran deal. During his major address to the UN, when Trump claimed to have accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of the U.S., the hundreds of diplomats and government officials gathered broke into open laughter. Your reporter spoke with Dee Parvez, global politics reporter with Think Progress, who assesses world reaction to President Trump's presence at this year's UN General Assembly.
Last year, President Trump took to the UN floor and threatened to, quote, totally destroy a country of 22 million or so, annihilate them. And then this year, he actually said before the UN Security Council meeting, which we'll get to in a second, that he'd gotten to know Chairman Kim and had gotten to like him quite a bit. this year at his general debate speech, you know, all the leaders get up and it's hours of all the leaders speechifying. He spoke for about 30 minutes. He was a little late in arriving, so they had to go out of order in order to accommodate that. And he basically gave a rather spectacular speech in some sense, in that it was a complete rebuke of globalism and multilateralism, which is, you know, the whole point of the UN, for everybody to work together. And he made it quite clear that the U.S. under his administration had no interest in that. And it got into the weeds a little bit. He started talking about how the U.S. would only help countries that did something for them, which is completely, you know, flies in the face of what something like humanitarian aid is, which is what they've cut to millions of Palestinians, for example. You know, it was quite a jarring speech, and everybody took note. And subsequent leaders who spoke, such as French President Emmanuel Macron, made a, you know, very pointed answer countering President Trump's speech, saying that, you know, the only way to move forward was to work with each other, and that we should resist such sentiment. Even President Hassan Rouhani of Iran said the same thing. A person who rejects multilateralism is not a strong person, but that doing so was, I think he's put it as a symptom of a weak intellect. Now, he never named President Trump, but everybody in the room knew exactly who he was talking about.
Dee Parvez, I did want to ask you about Donald Trump's refusal, along with the nation of Hungary, led by a right-wing government, to sign a global compact on migrants and refugees. As you wrote in your article, you talk about 68.5 million people have been displaced across the globe due to conflicts and natural disasters and famine and all that. Tell us a little bit about this particular compact that Trump, along with Hungary, refused to sign.
Very interesting company. So basically, the Obama administration in 2016, as his last UN summit in New York, launched the refugee summit. So basically, he got all the world leaders to get together, whoever would sign up to it, that is, to pledge, to make additional pledges to either monetarily or, you know, in terms of hosting more refugees. And the other part of that was that the member states vowed to get together and come up with a more comprehensive plan to handle migrants and refugees. So the Trump administration is largely focused on dismantling anything that President Obama put together. That seems to be a primary focus. And so, of course, they weren't going to sign on to this. Now, this is extremely disappointing to the rest of the world, to other member states, to global community. UNHCR had a high-level panel on this. There was a United States representative present there. This person did not speak at all, because what could they say? But yeah, it's remarkable that the U.S. has kept company with a very staunchly and harshly anti-refugee and anti-migrant government, and a very far right-wing government that, you know, even among right-wing governments in Europe is an outlier, which is Hungary and Viktor Orban.
To sum it up, Dee Parvez, what would you say the lasting result of this UN encounter between Trump and the nations of the world in New York last week?
Well, I think that, you know, it serves to make other nations more cautious, and not in a good way. He's not seen as a reliable, approachable leader, I don't think. So I think it damages any kind of, like, trust or diplomatic sort of protocol built over decades between the U.S. as a leader in a number of these U.N. institutions and councils, and the rest of the world, and, you know, other member states, our allies included.
That was Dee Parvez, global politics reporter with thinkprogress.org. Find a link to her article titled, "The UN General Assembly is Not Going So Well for President Trump," and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Urban planners and transportation advocates say that the single most important element that increases bicycling in cities and towns is a bike share program. That's where fleets of bikes are stationed around town in groups of 10 to 25, and people can rent them by the hour. Most major U.S. cities, like New York, Washington, D.C., Houston, Phoenix, Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, have bike share programs, along with many mid-sized cities. Between 2010 and 2016, bike share riders took more than 88 million trips, with New Yorkers being by far the most active bikers. In 2016, 56 cities and towns were listed as having bike share programs. That number doesn't include additional programs launched since then. New Haven, Connecticut, with a population of 130,000, for example, launched their bike program in February 2018. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Carolyn Lush, program manager with Bike New Haven. Here she explains how the city's public-private partnership differs from other big city bike share programs.
This is a public-private partnership with the City of New Haven. It is funded through a mix of user revenue and advertising. So it does not use any public money, any city money. And it is also unique compared with some cities in that it was really created with residents of New Haven in mind rather than tourists. Some bike share programs are really geared towards tourists. But
can you share with us some of the data? How many bikes are out there and their use and the different areas of the city and all that?
At the moment, we still just have 100 bikes, but we are very close to getting another 80 bikes out there. They're having the final touches put on right now in our warehouse. Our stations are throughout, mostly the more inner part of the city, but getting into some of the outer neighborhoods as well at this point. The first phase is going to be 300 bikes. So we hope by the end of this year to have 300 bikes out.
Okay. And then is there a plan for a second phase and more bikes?
Potentially going to have 400 because we'll have 40 stations. So 10 per station would be kind of the maximum. Aside from that, it really depends on what we see in terms of ridership. It depends on the feedback that we get, and we'll go from there.
Okay, so speaking of ridership, what can you tell us about that, just around the stations that you already have?
We have seen so far almost 7,000 rental sessions and 11,000 trips. So those two numbers are different because a rental session may contain more than one trip. Someone stops the bike to get coffee or do something else. So that is where we're at right now. We have over 7,000 miles cycled total, about 1,000 hours of cycling. We're happy with the learning curve that we've seen in terms of people starting to use the system more and more, and expect that to really continue once we get more of these bikes out there.
Explain exactly what someone does. Someone wants to rent a bike. They see these pretty green bikes out in various places. What do they do?
At the moment, someone would need to have a smartphone to use the system. And that's something that hopefully in the future we're going to work out other options. So on their phone, they would go to their app store and look for the Bike New Haven app. It's free. Download it and create an account with an email address and then link a credit card. And that is another thing we're working on, is getting cash-based passes, hopefully for the future. So once the credit card is linked and the account is made, then all you have to do is pull up the button that says scan to unlock and use your phone to scan the QR code on the back of whatever bike you are trying to unlock. That releases the lock on the rear wheel, and then the clock has started for the rental session.
And how long is the rental session?
A rental session is 45 minutes. And so all of the passes, whether it's a day pass, month or year pass, that's an increment of 45 minutes, unlimited 45-minute trips. Above that, if you go beyond 45 minutes, you're charged an extra amount, in most cases $2, for every additional 45-minute increment.
What does it actually cost? And are there tiers, or does everybody pay the same price?
We have our standard prices, which is $1.75 for just one 45-minute trip, and then $20 for a month pass and $90 for a year pass. However, we also have discounts. We have a senior and student rate, which is $50 for a year pass. And we also have a $15 year pass that's available for people who are on state benefits.
Wow. That's pretty reasonable. So among all your data there, do you have a breakout of people who are in those different categories or what they pay? Or is it people who work downtown or is it kids who live out in the different neighborhoods? Or do you have any of that data?
We've seen a really great variety of that. And we did do a survey of our mailing list recently to see how people are using the system, and it was just a wide variety of things that people put down that they use it to get to work, to get to the grocery store, to go to coffee shops and restaurants, to go to doctor's appointments. So we've seen it used in a variety of ways, and we are hoping to spread the word about those reduced cost passes and about how to use it so that we can get more and more people using it.
That was Carolyn Lush, program manager with Bike New Haven. Learn more about bike share programs in the U.S. and around the world by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Prison health in an unhealthy place. It is, at first blush, somewhat odd to expect health care in a place where, essentially, no one really cares about you. Prisons are the slums of the state, for it is, more often than not, an abode of the poor and the dwelling place of the impoverished. Prisons rarely house the wealthy, and to a lesser degree, the same might be said of the healthy. They are a social political construction erected to provide recession-proof jobs to rural, depressed, white communities. These communities, in turn, benefit from the plethora of jobs attracted by prisons, not just in the realm of so-called security, but health care as well. It should therefore surprise no one that the health care provided is of substantially lower quality than the poor health care provided to poor communities and in working-class neighborhoods. One of the most significant challenges facing both prisoners and free communities is hepatitis C, which causes liver damage and related illnesses. While Hep C is actually curable, the cost of antiviral drugs is prohibitive. The going market price for these drugs is about $1,000 a pill, or about $90,000 for a full daily regimen of its, say, 8 to 12 weeks. Who can afford that? Free or imprisoned. But health, like any other social good, comes through struggle. There have been legal attacks, yes, protests and public calls for making these drugs available. Some have prevailed. Others have not. The struggle continues across the country. Thank you for your time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Charges of law professor Anita Hill against then-judge, now Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. A lot has changed since then. Or has it? The French have a saying, plus ça change, or the more things change, the more they stay the same. The charges of sexual harassment now poised against the sitting judge and possible justice, Brett Kavanaugh, by a psychology professor, Dr. Christine M. Ford, of events that occurred over 30 years ago shows us that things have changed very little. For power remains a mostly male prerogative, and women, unless they act as manlike as possible, are more often than not treated like children, seen and not heard. For at the nexus between law and power lies the courts, one of the last mighty bastions of male power. The remarkable Me Too movement may have enormous power in the realm of culture, think Hollywood, but law remains a largely male preserve still. Women, the majority of the U.S. population, are not the majority of political leaders, don't earn the highest incomes, and aren't paid wages equal to men. In other words, their power is quite limited. They are, however, the highest number of law students, so this may prove a coming day that they will dominate the field, but not today. Manpower still reigns in politics and law, and unless I miss my guess, in the next few days, we shall see Brett Kavanaugh don the dark robe of a junior justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. I was wrong. In my last commentary, entitled Manpower, I assumed that Dr. Christine B. Ford's claim of sexual harassment would not scuttle Judge Brett Kavanaugh's swift ascension to the Supreme Court. As soon as I recorded, I returned to the cell, turned on the TV, and CNN's breaking news was really, well, breaking news. Another woman who knew Kavanaugh when he went to college described a remarkable episode of him exposing himself to her whilst in a drunken stupor. The woman, Deborah Ramirez, claimed she pushed him away. This may change the game. For one woman may suggest an incident, but two women means a problem. Is this a true picture of the man? Truth is, no one knows, but it suggests the judge, as a young man, had an alcohol and sex problem. Who knows what this will do to his nomination? His chances, which once looked so bright, now looks iffy at best. If he loses a handful of votes, his chance to join the nation's highest court may go down in flames. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Almost 50,000 men and women held in 24-hour solitary confinement for almost 2 weeks in their cells. Why? Ostensibly because of several dozen staffers who were said to sicken because of drug exposures. Medical experts in drugs, chemistry, and drug treatment heard the DOC claims and poo-pooed them. The drugs they described, like K2, a chemical form of marijuana, simply didn't produce the symptoms they described. Indeed, the DOC staffers' symptoms were more in line with what some scientists have called mass psychogenic illness, or a mental reaction to fear and paranoia. In response, the DOC attacked prisoners and their friends and families by outlawing and banning books, by replacing mail, by Xeroxing copies of letters, and by Xeroxing all legal mail and holding the originals for weeks. On visits, they removed all food and drink from vending machines. In a word, the DOC went mad, and almost 50,000 men and women suffered for what may be the actions of perhaps a dozen people. Ain't nothing correct about that. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Why would Canada's most prominent left-wing political party promote U.S.-led efforts to overthrow governments in Ukraine, Venezuela, and elsewhere? Why is the Canadian Labour Congress oriented behind a charity as opposed to a solidarity model for foreign policy? Why did Canadian unions become staunch cold warriors after the Second World War? Why do prominent left commentators in the Canadian media concede the myth of Canadian benevolence on the world stage? How can authentic anti-war and solidarity activists counter the propaganda enabling empire in the guise of a progressive foreign policy? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we host a conversation with one of Canada's most prominent dissident foreign policy analysts, Eve Engler, as he prepares to embark on a cross-Canada tour of his latest book. On this week's program, The Canadian Left as Agent of War and Empire, a conversation with Eve Engler. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research NewsHour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 5th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Very few Americans know who Sheldon Adelson is, and fewer still appreciate that as America's leading political donor, when he speaks, the Republican Party listens. By virtue of his largesse, he has been able to direct GOP policy in the Middle East in favor of Israel, which might well be regarded as his true home, while the United States exists more as a faithful friend that can be produced at intervals whenever Israel finds itself in need of a bit of cash or political cover. Adelson's recent successes in translating his political donations into policy favorable to Israel have included shifting the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, cutting aid to Palestinians, ending the Iranian nuclear monitoring agreement, and closing the Palestine Liberation Organization's diplomatic office in Washington. All those Trump administration measures were reportedly worked out privately by Adelson, speaking directly with the president. Adelson's activities in buying politicians reflect what he believes, he reportedly having said that, quote, there's no such thing as a Palestinian. That comes from the article Best Government Money Can Buy by Philip Giraldi, posted October 4th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. The anthrax attack was exploited in standard problem-reaction-solution fashion. After the attack and media hyperactivity, the U.S. once again began throwing money into biological warfare research. The government gave the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases $1.5 billion in 2003, and Congress passed Project BioShield Act, which provided $5.6 billion over 10 years for the purchase of new vaccines and drugs, thus providing transnational pharmaceutical corporations a welcome influx of taxpayer money. How long before a revitalized cadre of neocons folded within the Trump administration blamed this attack on Iran or Russia? The UK set the example when it blamed Russia for the Skripal Novichok poisonings, a transparent and completely baseless accusation that was embraced by the US and its parroting corporate media. That comes from the article Anthrax False Flag Redux by Kurt Nimmo, posted October 3rd, originally appearing at the author's blog site, Another Day in the Empire. Near war's end at 36 years of age, Skorzeny was at the peak of his global prestige and physical powers, known as the most dangerous man in Europe, resulting in America's supreme commander, Dwight D. Eisenhower, having his personal security presence significantly bolstered in Western Europe. Skorzeny cut a formidable figure at 6 feet 4 inches tall with peaked cap, binoculars, and iron cross, while draped in Waffen-SS tunic and winter overcoat. The scar on his left cheekbone running down to the chin, inflicted in 1928 during a dueling bout, betrayed itself when approaching close to him. Having been involved from the June 1941 launch of Operation Barbarossa with the SS division Das Reich, Skorzeny was long acquainted with his Russian adversaries, whom he called, quote, brave, tough, and with an outstanding sense of camouflage, they put up astonishingly bitter resistance, unquote. He dedicated his extensive 1975 memoirs to, quote, the true heroes of the Second World War, the common Russian and German soldier, unquote. That comes from the article, History of World War II, Hitler's Favorite Commando and Committed Nazi, Otto Skorzeny, by Shane Quinn, posted October 3rd. The reality is that Moscow signed the non-aggression pact with the Germans because its leadership believed that the only way to preserve the security of the USSR after its quest for collective security with London and Paris had failed, and to buy time for an inevitable conflict with Germany, though Stalin was not convinced of this inevitability, was to sign an agreement with Berlin. Hitler agreed to the pact with the Soviet Union so that this would give him a free hand to fight France and Britain without the fear of the Soviets attacking him from the rear. In short, the Nazi-Soviet pact was not a pact of friendship, but a pact of convenience. On the 80th anniversary of the Munich Agreement, Britain and France have a moral responsibility to apologize to the people of the former Czechoslovakia for disregarding their country's sovereignty and territorial integrity and to recognize the enormous ramifications for Europe and its people of the shame and tragedy that was Munich. And it is high time that British and French politicians and journalists alike learn about the Soviet Union's search for collective security with London and Paris to deter Hitler from aggression because, had the Russians been successful, it is just possible that the most devastating war in history could have been averted. That comes from the article, 80 Years On, The Shame and Tragedy of the 1938 Munich Agreement by Marcus Papadopoulos, posted October 3rd, originally appearing at Morning Star. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. CKUW 95.9 FM, the station which hosts Global Research News Hour, is celebrating Pass the Mic Week, an annual event in which programmers are encouraged to allow community members without regular access to the airwaves to take over hosting for all or part of a program. In keeping with this tradition, the Global Research News Hour is passing the reins to Winnipeg-based community videographer, citizen journalist, anti-war activist, and associate, Paul Graham. Here he is with an exclusive interview with Eve Engler.
Eve Engler is a Montreal-based activist and author. He has published 10 books, most of which deal with one or another aspect of Canadian foreign policy. Eve is on a national tour this October to promote his most recent book, entitled Left-Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. Left-Right details and analyzes the various ways in which the Canadian left, which has challenged powerful corporate interests domestically, tends to reinforce, or at best, be silent when it comes to imperialist foreign policy. In this interview, Eve provides more details about how and why the Canadian left, including the labor unions, Canada's most prominent left-wing political party, the New Democratic Party, and outspoken commentators such as Michael Byers and Stephen Lewis, have aligned with corporate interests abroad. Perhaps before we start looking at the specific players that are addressed in the book, you could give me a definition of what you deem to be good, solid foreign policy. What should we be doing that we're not doing?
I mean, that's also a somewhat complicated question, in the sense that I think that foreign policy decisions are issue specific. There's some general principles, and I do provide some general principles in the book. One being do unto others as you would have done unto yourself principle, which is a pretty basic idea of, if you wouldn't want that to happen to you, don't do it elsewhere. So if you don't like the idea of a foreign country dropping bombs on your country, then maybe that's best not to do elsewhere. But that's obviously a very general principle that doesn't necessarily tell us that much about certain day-to-day decisions. Also, I provide the first do no harm idea. Our political culture is very much driven by this idea that Canada should be doing more in the world, and really sort of spans the political spectrum of let's intervene. Let's either intervene through at the hard militarist end. Let's intervene through more Canadian NATO missions at the more sort of liberal end. It's let's intervene with more Canadian aid, or let's intervene with more Canadian responsibility to protect. And too often, lost in that mix is the principle of Canadian foreign policy, which is let's make sure first off let's not do any harm, as medical doctors are supposed to operate by, and I think that's also that principle is grounded in international law. But when you get into the specifics, I mean, there's you really have to look at every different case. So, for instance, right now with Venezuela, you have a Canadian government that's pushing to intervene, has sanctioned the Venezuelan government in three different series of sanctions, which, of course, contravene international law, is working to support opposition groups, has pushed to bring Venezuela to the International Criminal Court. In this case, Canada should just stop doing its interventionist meddling policies. That would be a good foreign policy. And from the standpoint of a left political party or a labor union or just a left-wing commentator, what they should be saying is Canada should stop with this support of a U.S.-led effort to topple an elected government in Venezuela, which has many problems. But at the end of the day, it's an elected government. It's up to Venezuelans to decide how to go about changing government or improving their situation. So there isn't just one principle of Canadian foreign policy or foreign policy for any country for that matter. It's very much issue specific, but there are some sort of general principles that I outline a bit in the book.
Right, and you also cover quite a number of specific issues in the book, and maybe we can use some of those to talk about the role of the NDP and prior to that the CCF. It's remarkable that if you consider, you just rattle off half a dozen country names, the NDP CCF has come down on the wrong side consistently with regard to Iran, Iraq, Haiti, Afghanistan, Libya, Ukraine, former Yugoslavia, Syria, Venezuela. What have I missed?
Korea, I believe.
Right. How did this get started?
Well, first thing I would say that the CCF, going back to the Regina Manifesto, sort of laying the basis for the party, already you can see that foreign policy issues are downgraded in their proposals. They do put forward anti-war and even some anti-imperialist kind of language. Certainly after World War One, which was just a total disaster by any sort of humanist perspective, there was a lot of anti-war feeling and that's reflected in the CCF early on. But early on, you see that there is no or is very limited challenging of Canadian power in the Caribbean. For instance, the Canadian banks, which dominated the Caribbean at that time while it was under British colonial rule, you don't see that being brought up by the CCF in the 1930s. Spain was an example where the CCF was on the right side in terms of opposing the Franco's fascists. But there's already a sort of nationalistic kind of component to CCF early thinking, which again, like I said, sort of downgrades or ignores corporate Canada's power in the hemisphere, particularly in the Caribbean. Also, Canadian connections with British colonial rule all across the African continent, which were not insignificant. But it is true that it's really after World War II. The CCF just completely adopts the Cold War thinking, backs the creation of NATO in 1949, supports the Korean War of 1950, and actually not just supports it, they support Canada sending gunboats to Korea, but then they prod the government to send ground troops before that decision had been made. So this is a war that ends up leaving millions dead. Point within the war, they do turn against the war because it becomes clear what this is all about, which is about American power and vis-a-vis China and Asia, and so they do turn against the war part of the way through. But for the 2 decades after the World War II, the CCF very much aligns with official Canadian/US/British foreign policy. And they're aggressive proponents of imperialism. And so as the political party has actually gone to the right with their domestic policies. Now, back in the day, CCF would talk about capitalism, would talk about social ownership. Today, of course, the NDP very rarely talks about those things. You see, the NDP today on foreign policy issues has become very limited in their criticism of official Canadian policy. Strong proponents of Canadian militarism, strong proponents of increasing the Canadian military budget. So, for instance, in June of last year, when the Liberal government announced the 70% increase in military spending over 10 years, the NDP foreign critic Randall Garrison criticized the Trudeau government for not putting more of that money up front right away, supporting the bombing of Libya in 2011. The NDP voted for two different UN or voted for two different House of Commons resolutions supporting the bombing of Libya in 2011. So they have become staunchly supportive of Canadian militarism, I would say that it's in many ways worse today than at the founding of the CCF. But if you look back at the history, even at the founding, when it was a much more of a socialistic minded political movement, you still see some blank spots, if you like, on foreign policy questions.
Well, two things jumped out at me when I was reading your account of the NDP and the CCF through the years. That you alluded to. One of them was there's on some things anyway, there seemed to be a division between the leadership of the party and the rank and file, or at least, important parts of the rank and file over foreign policy questions. And I guess the other thing that struck me is the profound impact of the Cold War, anti-communism and so on. Do you want to amplify on any of that?
Yeah, I think the division question between the leadership and the membership is a very important question. There's many facets to that. One, you go right back to, you know, the CCF supporting the Korean War. That was done in a way just before the convention taking place up in Vancouver in 1950, and it was done explicitly. The Executive Council came out before the convention, just before the convention, and stated very strongly, we support the war and we want ground troops. And there was anger among members who wanted to actually debate the issue. Same thing with NATO. It's more complicated in that there was constant debates at conventions over NATO, with the leadership consistently backing NATO and the membership bringing that up at convention after convention, and finally, not till the late 1960s, they're able to actually get a sort of partial victory on the question of calling for Canada to pull out of NATO. That's a battle you see that goes on till today, right? You had the most recent convention on the question of Palestine. There was a huge groundswell behind this fairly moderate Palestine resolution. More than 25 riding associations have backed it. The youth convention unanimously backed it. Many different NDP affiliated groups backing this resolution, and the leadership blocked it from even being discussed by the convention. They pulled all kinds of shenanigans to make it so that this resolution, that was the most widely supported foreign policy resolution, couldn't even be discussed at the convention. And that's this kind of perspective that has been, I think, the overwhelming dominant perspective within the party leadership, which is basically to keep the activist opinion on foreign policy issues marginalized. The mere matter of debating these issues is viewed as sort of embarrassing to the party leadership when it comes to the dominant media. And so they do what they can to try to just make it difficult to even have discussions of these issues. So that's a very important part of the whole question of NDP, CCF, foreign policy. And a sort of element of that is also the fact that this is not, you know, there is lots of ignorance within the, you know, membership of the party on different foreign policy questions. There's no doubt that the lack of knowledge about, you know, what's going on in Venezuela today, for instance, is a problem within the party. But at the upper echelons of the party, the problem is not just ignorance. I mean, they actively try to suppress discussion and debate on these issues, and there's a whole history that I detail in the book of these efforts of trying to sort of suppress debate, which like I said, it shows that the leadership is has made their decision not based upon not knowing stuff, but based upon certain political calculations, and I think those political calculations are heavily driven by what's considered acceptable by the dominant media.
Maybe we could turn and talk about the labor movement more generally. In some respects, I would imagine the labor movement and the NDP involve many of the same people, but not all. And labor's approach to foreign policy, in the book, you talk about some positive things and some, you know, quite negative things. Maybe we could start off by talking about the CLC's, what you call a charity orientation to international affairs.
Yeah, I mean, the Canadian Labour Congress, first of all, most of their funding for international affairs projects has come from the Canadian International Development Agency, which is now collapsed into Global Affairs Canada. So it's come from the official Canadian, you know, Canadian state's foreign policy. And so that obviously constrains what you can do with that money. And the Harper government actually cut back their funding, which basically collapsed the CLC's, much of the CLC's foreign policy division. Within the affiliates of the Canadian Labour Congress, steelworkers, Unifor, they have humanities funds, which is set up a couple decades, began being set up a couple decades ago. And these funds often, each employee and each employer will put, you know, a penny or two an hour of work into these funds. And, you know, in principle, I think it's a really good idea. You have to bargain these into contracts. The unions bargain them into contracts, forcing the employer to pay a bit and also members to pay a bit. But how they've mostly been modeled is as charity. I mean, and international charity, you know, it's sort of tied into the NGO world. And international charity, they generally have tax-deductible status, which brings with it constraints on your political activity. I haven't done like an analysis of every different project that all the different humanities funds have pursued abroad, but I did look at the Unifor humanities funds. Of the projects listed on their website, there was only one that sort of in any way dealt with Canada. There was a project that they pursuing with oil workers in Colombia, and it was a Canadian listed oil company that the workers were in battle with. So there was sort of an indirect element of Canadian policy. But other projects, one on specifically on in Haiti, which was supporting victims of the earthquake who'd been made handicapped. Earthquake of 2010 in Haiti, who had been injured, and there's nothing about any of the political context. So, for instance, Canada helped overthrow an elected government in Haiti in 2004. Canada is a huge political player in Haiti. All that's just ignored in the Unifor project, and it's just, you know, let's help these children who were victim of the earthquake, which are, you know, in the narrow. No doubt helpful. I mean, people who were injured would generally appreciate some form of help. But if you look, you know, the case of Haiti is one it's abundantly clear. This is the, you know, NGO capital of the world. There's all these different international charity organizations that are all supposedly helping Haiti, and Haiti is a disaster where, you know, they don't have a public school system. They have foreign NGOs running schools. They don't barely have a health system. Same thing. It's foreigners running that. That's not what unions would call for in Canada, right? What we call for in Canada would be a public school system, a public healthcare system that is responsive to the democratic demands of the population. But then when it comes to, you know, a place like Haiti or elsewhere, we're willing to, you know, engage in or support a different type of model, which leaves most Haitians fairly powerless in demanding, you know, better health services, education services, etc. So the model that unions have pursued, ironically, is not with regards to these humanities funds, is generally not the type of model of political developments that the unions generally pursue in Canada. For the most part, in Canada, unions view political struggle and demands on government as the best way to overcome social ills. When it comes to their foreign, or at least their humanities funds, for the most part, they get into this model of charities. And if you look into it, you'll find that the Canadian Labour Congress is very much connected in with the Canadian Council for International Cooperation, which is the main NGO umbrella group in Ottawa, which was set up in the late 60s with funding from the Canadian International Development Agency. And it's the model of charity as the way to deal with problems, rather than the model of political engagement, of international solidarity. And I would argue that a union that is committed to to internationalism needs to be challenging Canadian foreign policy. That's the most important thing that we can do sitting here in Canada to alleviate inequalities in this world is by prodding our government, our corporations that are contributing to these inequalities to stop doing that. And the union's charity model of international engagement doesn't deal with that.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
There's a long history, isn't there, of the unions largely being the creature of American foreign policy through manipulation of labor internationals and so on and so forth. Can you provide a little context there?
Yeah, battles between. I mean, the CIA played a role in the creation of the ICFTU to undermine what they claim to be Soviet. Backed labor federation that united much of Western Europe. And Canadian unions, the predecessors to the CLC, played a small part in that process. And Canadian unions supported things like the Marshall Plan. And the Marshall Plan of post-World War II Marshall Plan, part of the objective of the Marshall Plan from American planners' perspective was to break off Italian and French unions from their support for the world, I'm forgetting the name, the World Trade Union Federation that the CIA claimed was Soviet backed. So Canadian unions participated in that, and Canadian unions, early Canadian union leaders were very close to external affairs, to official Canadian foreign policy, and they ended up with all kinds of positions, labor attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Washington. They ended up with different positions within the Canadian foreign policy establishment or Canadian foreign policy realm. So they went alongside these efforts, and the American efforts are very well detailed, where CIA spent huge amounts of money in Italy, the one I looked into the most, of supporting the weakening of the communist dominated unions at the time, and that was a really important objective of American foreign policy after World War II. And of course, the Americans intervention in Italian election where the communists probably would have won if it wasn't for major American intervention in 1947. And Canadian unions generally went along with that, and just as they went along with some of the British colonial labor policy in Africa during the colonial period in the 1950s, where Canadian union officials would go on these international union missions where they would echo British policy and about the Mau Mau revolt in Kenya, for instance, where the British brutally repressed the anti-colonial struggle there. And Canadian labor officials would participate in these initiatives and basically echo what British officials were saying. So the Canadian unions in the two decades after World War II, they were staunch Cold War warriors, even more so than the CCF. That changed by, you know, the late 60s through the 70s. And it changed, I think, in large part because of the anti-war movements, anti-Vietnam War movement, and then with the South Africa solidarity movements and Central America solidarity movements, very much broke the unions away from being these imperialist hawks. But I would say today, the labor unions, for the most part, their foreign policy is not, unlike the NDP, which is aligned often quite explicitly, sometimes not, but often quite explicitly with Canadian imperialism. Labor unions, that's not the case, or rarely the case today. For the most part, unions have stay silent on important foreign policy issues. And of course, you know, silence when you have policies being pursued, you can't be neutral on a moving train. So just because you stay silent about Canada's role in undercutting democracy in Venezuela, it doesn't stop the Canadian government from undercutting democracy in Venezuela. So labor unions basically leave the foreign policy realm to the hands of the corporations and to the Canadian government. That's, I say, the main criticism of labor unions policy today. But in the two decades, after, maybe 25, 30 years after World War II, they were in many cases very staunch, aggressive supporters of U.S. / Canadian imperialism.
You talk about left-wing institutions and left-wing intellectuals, and how they have become creators and for that matter, amplifiers of the official story from Ottawa. You want to amplify that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I have a section that deals with Linda McQuaig and others' distortion of Lester Pearson's foreign policy, and their sort of echoing of the myth of Pearson as this peacekeeper trying to bring development to the world and stuff like that. When as I detailed in a previous book, Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt, the just abundance of evidence suggesting that it's completely absurd to frame Pearson as being a sort of internationalist, anti-imperialist, like they try to frame him, and that's, you know, part of the mythology. That's the Pearson myth is an important part of Canadian liberal foreign policy mythology. And I also deal with Stephen Lewis, who's obviously a more high profile a figure than Linda McQuaig. This is somebody who's considered the big defender of Africa in Canada. And basically in the section on Stephen Lewis, I show how the only criticism of Canada's role in Africa that I see that Stephen Lewis puts forward is that we don't do enough. Right. There's not enough Canadian aid in Africa. Nothing about the, you know, billions of dollars being extracted from the continent by Canadian mining companies annually. Nothing about the whole history of Canadians' role in the conquering of the continent in the 1800s and in the Canadians who were governors of different British colonial colonies in Kenya, Ghana, Northern Nigeria, nothing about Canada's role in supporting the European NATO powers in the 1950s while they were suppressing the anti-colonial movement. And I'm talking about massive Canadian military aid to the European colonial powers as they suppressed struggles against their rule in Algeria, Congo, Kenya, etc. So it's a whole criticism of in the case of Stephen Lewis, and this generalizes to the official left wing foreign policy mainstream left wing foreign policy discussion, is that you can't survive as a columnist in the Toronto Star or as someone speaking on CBC if you say that the world needs less Canada. That's just outside of bounds. even if the facts actually suggest that's probably the case. So I think that the major left-wing foreign policy commentators are they concede a great deal to the official narrative of Canadian foreign policy, in large part because for a series of structural reasons that make it very difficult to survive by articulating more substantive criticisms of Canadian foreign policy.
One of the things that comes through quite clearly in the book and in your discussion of left-wing institutions and intellectuals is their promotion of the persistent Canadian myth that our peacekeeping efforts abroad have been benevolent and progressive and helpful and welcomed. Your reference to Mr. Lewis. Was he not part of efforts to sanitize the whole Rwandan episode, the mass killings, the turning of Romeo Dallaire into a Latter-day Saint?
Yeah, I mean, I have this. The book has a section dealing with Romeo Dallaire and how Romeo Dallaire has been upheld as this great benevolent figure by a whole swath of left-wing media institutions, commentators, and they have or underpinning this mythology of Romeo Dallaire is a much more complicated human rights catastrophe in Rwanda in the early 1990s. What's commonly described as the Rwandan genocide is a totally simplistic, one-sided account of a complex tragedy. And Romeo Dallaire very much underpins this simplistic account. And Stephen Lewis specifically, most people, it's most of the commentators I refer to, it's a much more ignorant upholding of Romeo Dallaire. But Stephen Lewis played this important role on this international committee that actually wrote the African Union, or the predecessor, the Organization of African Organization of African Unity, I believe, that actually wrote their statement, 300-word position paper, if you like, on what happened in Rwanda in 1994. It was actually Stephen Lewis's close friend who wrote that, with Stephen Lewis being the one who instigated it. So it was actually the official policy about what happened in Rwanda put out by the predecessors of the African Union was written by a guy sitting in Toronto, and he says that very openly. But it's a total distortion of what happened in Rwanda, and it's there's a whole background to that that distortion that's a little bit complicated to get into all the details. But a lot of it is unraveling. It's even starting to unravel on the pages of the Globe and Mail, where of course it was Paul Kagame's forces that shot down the plane that led to the mass killings in the spring of 1994. There's the background to the fact that it was a foreign invasion from Uganda in 1990. That's the background to all the killing that transpires over the next 4 years, and even for that matter, a lot of the killing that transpires in the Congo over subsequent decades. All of that's wiped out from our understanding of what happened in Rwanda in 1994, and you have this Romeo Dallaire as the savior story, when in fact he had objectively aligned with the aggressors, in the case being Uganda, Rwandan Patriotic Front forces that had invaded Rwanda from from Uganda in 1990, and even his boss on the UN mission, Jacques Roger Boubou, who is the former foreign minister of Cameroon, he actually wrote a whole book called Le Patron de Dallaire Parle, so the boss of Dallaire speaks, which talks about how Dallaire had – Dallaire was in charge of the military side of the mission, and Jacques Roger Boubou was in charge of the entire mission, the political side. And he details how Roméo Dallaire had sided with the RPF, totally contrary to UN rules. But this sort of the complicated history of what happened in Rwanda and Uganda and the Congo is almost entirely wiped out, and what you have as just this, you know, great Canadian savior, and it's this liberal nationalist ideology, mythology, really, of a benevolent Canada taken to this incredible extreme, where I argue in the book, and I don't want to overstate the case, but I think there's a truth to this, that the whole conception of what happened in Rwanda in 1994 has been distorted by liberal nationalist Canadians who want to uphold this idea of benevolent Canada. And you can just sort of, you know, say, okay, well, there's a distortion of a historical incident, you know, sort of who cares? But in this case, the distortion of this historical incident has been the main way in which Paul Kagame, the brutal dictator in Rwanda, has maintained his power. It has maintained his control over Rwanda, but also it was the basis justifying his invasions of the Congo, which has led to literally millions and millions of people dead. Now, I don't want to overstate the role of Canadian liberal nationalists in this. Obviously, it's Kagame's ties to Washington and to London that are, you know, more important than liberal nationalist mythology. But there is a real element of liberal nationalist mythology. And what brought this to my attention was this review of a couple books about Rwanda in Monthly Review by a Canadian union researcher considered fairly left wing, where he goes out of his way to mythologize, to talk about Roméo Dallaire as this great individual, and talk about Stephen Lewis as these great individuals with regards to Rwanda. And again, this is in a review of two books about Rwanda in a Marxist American publication, and there's these liberal nationalist Canadian tropes being presented. And I think it's just one example, which I detail in the book, of how Roméo Dallaire has become this symbol of benevolent Canada. And if you look at Roméo Dallaire's record, this is somebody who has, you know, supported the intervention in Haiti in 2004, the coup in Haiti in 2004, who supports ballistic missile defense, who supports attacks against Iran, who supports increasing Canadian military spending. This is somebody who it makes no sense whatsoever that progressive Canadians would consider the Roméo Dallaire some sort of figure to uphold. But over and over and over again, they do. And it's tied into this idea that we are, you know, this benevolent international force, and Roméo Dallaire sort of personifies that.
That brings us to an overarching theme of the book. We're basically captives of our own ignorance. And so you've proposed a partial solution to that, that you call the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute. You want to talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I want to just say before getting into that, this book, my most recent book, is sort of a part two of my previous book, which was called A Propaganda System: How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. And as I mentioned at the start of Left Right, That previous book answers 90% of the question of why we're so confused about Canada's role in the world. And it looks at the dominant media, the military, academic institutions, you know, funded by corporations, funded by the military, and how they have distorted the foreign policy discussion. This book is really just 10% left over, which is how the left has not put up a challenge to the dominant sort of propaganda institutions of Canadian foreign policy. So that's one thing I want to say, which you sort of alluded to in your previous comment. Now, in terms of the how do we counteract both the dominant foreign policy propaganda institutions, the media, you know, the military is the biggest public relations entity in this country. You know, it has hundreds and hundreds of full-time employees trying to convince us that they're doing good stuff or convince us of their perspective of the world. So how do we combat that? Now, I think that the main way we combat it is through the activism, the solidarity activism, the anti-war activism that is taking place by magnifying, amplifying what's already going on. There's you know, peace groups in most cities in the country. Many of them are largely dormant. Some of them are a bit more active than others. It's about, you know, making those groups more active. There have been times in Canadian history where there has been a lot of activism on some of these issues. The most probably successful example was in the lead up to the 2003 war on Iraq, where the anti-war movements were able to at least have Canada not officially join the George Bush administration's coalition of the willing that invaded Iraq. Canada did still support the war in different ways, but the biggest, most important thing we're able to stop. So there are instances where the anti-war movements or the, you know, the mining solidarity movements, which have had some successes, you know, fighting against what Canadian mining companies are doing in Guatemala or elsewhere and trying to bring in restrictions on Canadian government support for those mining companies. So there is that activism exists. The main thing that needs to happen is to amplify that activism. One of our problems is it's not all the anti-war movements of the 60s against Vietnam, the Central America Solidarity, South Africa, you know, even Palestine. For the most part, it's very difficult to institutionalize it. It's had an impact on the political culture. There has been this effect on political culture by all this activism. I would argue that we actually are more internationalist today and less racist than we were 50, 100 years ago. And we have sort of those movements have been able to constrain how the Canadian military fights. So they're still brutal, but they're not as brutal as they were during the Korean War, for instance. So that activism, and the activism sort of has been institutionalized in a certain way in some left-wing media, but it's very difficult to sustain the organizations. Now, what I'm proposing in the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute at the initial phase, and people can go check it out online today at foreignpolicy.ca. Initial phase is just an effort to bring together critical information about Canadian foreign policy. So all the best articles, podcasts, whatnot, dealing with Canadian foreign policy, from a critical perspective. There's a list of the best books on Canadian foreign policy. There's a couple dozen books listed on the website of dealing with different elements of Canadian foreign policy. So an initial phase is just basically a sort of repository of critical information about Canadian foreign policy. Now, with time, and if there's resources that are found and developed, the sky's the limit. But there's a need there's a potential for, you know, doing some elements of what a traditional think tank does of producing reports with the intention of trying to have those reports picked up by the dominant media. There's a possibility of setting up chapters in different cities across the country. There's a speakers bureau of different individuals that one of the things that I'm working on setting up of different individuals who are, you know, sort of experts, if you like, on Canada-Saudi relations, or the people who are experts from a critical perspective on Canada's role in Haiti, and offering those individuals both to media and to activist groups looking for a speaker to deal with whatever issue. So there's many facets to what the Institute could be. Initially, it's just a repository of critical information in Canadian foreign policy. And over the years, hopefully it will be an entity that can provide a platform to many of the different activist groups taking on specific elements of Canadian foreign policy, and also have some sort of help in sort of consciousness raising in terms of people seeing Canadian foreign policy from a multi-faceted perspective, that there is a connection between Canada's warmongering abroad and Canadian mining companies being powerful players. There's a connection between Canada overthrowing or trying to overthrow an elected government and Canadian companies being major international investors. So part of the objective of the Foreign Policy Institute is to amplify the work that the different activist groups are doing, but also to provide, a bit bigger picture of Canadian foreign policy.
It sounds all very ambitious.
I think we'll leave it there. except we're going to repeat once again that the web address is foreignpolicy.ca, and you're going to be soon on tour throughout the month of October, and the details, I gather, can be found on your website, eveengler.com. Am I right?
Yep, all the events are on at eveengler.com, and I invite people to come out and to spread the word.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Montreal-based author and activist Eve Engler speaking with community videographer, citizen journalist, and Global Research TV associate Paul Graham about his recently released book, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. Eve Engler's 2018 book tour is taking him to cities across Canada. His first stop is Montreal on Friday, October 5th at 6 p.m. at Salle de Révolution, 3720 Avenue du Parc. On Wednesday, October 10th, he will be in Ottawa at the University of Ottawa at 2:30 p.m. in room 429 of the Simard building, and later at 7 p.m. at 251 Bank Street on the second floor. On Wednesday, October 17th, Eve Engler will be in Winnipeg. He speaks at Menno Simons College at the University of Winnipeg at 520 Portage Avenue at 2:30 p.m. Then at 7 p.m., he speaks at Université de Saint-Boniface, 200 Avenue de la Cathédrale, in room 2322. Thursday, October 18th, Eve Engler will be in Regina, Saskatchewan at 5 p.m. in the Knox Met United Church at 2340 Victoria Avenue in room 105. Saturday, October 20th at 1 p.m., Eve will be in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan at the Man Art Gallery. Sunday, October 21st, Eve Engler will be in Saskatoon at the Turning the Tide Bookstore at 615 Main Street. Monday, October 22nd at 7 p.m., he will be in Edmonton, Alberta at the University of Alberta Education Center South in room 158. Tuesday, October 23rd at 7 p.m., he's in Calgary at the Community Wise Resource Center, or the old Y building at 223 12th Avenue Southwest. Then on Wednesday, October 24th at 7 p.m., he will be in Calgary at the Mount Royal University Jenkins Theatre to participate in a debate on Canada's Israel policy. Further speaking dates are planned for Nelson, B.C. on the 25th, Kelowna, B.C. on the 26th, Vancouver on the 27th and the 30th, Victoria on November 1st and 2nd, Courtney, B.C. on Monday, November 5th, and Nanaimo, B.C. on Tuesday, November 6th. Updates can be found on Eve Engler's website at eveengler.com. That's eveengler.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to this week's special guest interviewer, Paul Graham. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.